It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered my home.
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and threaten me.
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have 2 more hours of this.
And maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want.
Still coming down from the high of night one of WrestleMania. We have 1 more night left to go. But first, this is episode 802 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, April 2nd, 2023. It's been a very busy weekend of wrestling. A lot of shows. We're going to be talking about a lot of them here on the podcast today. Not only night one of WrestleMania, kind of a quick synopsis, and I've got some additional thoughts from the stream last night that I did not get to, but also watched NXT Stand and Deliver. Finally finished the Ring of Honor Super Card of Honor show, and we're going to get into all of that stuff here as part of the podcast today. We're going to take your questions. We have news to talk about as far as WWE and AEW is concerned. So we're going to get into it, including, by the way, thoughts on the AEW All Access debut. Their new reality show premiered on Wednesday night. I did watch the first episode, so I'll be talking about that as well. But it was a very late night. Thank you to everybody who joined me and stayed up late last night. All well over 3,000 plus of you who were hanging out with me for WrestleMania 39. Hopefully we can top that tonight. Live after night two. I want to thank our PayPal producers. I want to go through roll call here and say thank you to the Angel of Anarchy, Lucas Kroll. The support that Lucas threw my way this week is something I have not seen in a very long time, and I want to thank him for it. He lives 40 miles south of Los Angeles, and he said that he would be attempting to pull off his own Mania Weekend gauntlet from the New Japan Impact Multiverse United show, Super Card of Honor, both nights of WrestleMania. So, Lucas, I hope it's been a fun one for you so far. I've got a little bit of FOMO going on. I'm not going to lie. Got a little bit of FOMO going on here right now. I feel like I'm missing out on all the fun. So, have some for me. And again, thank you for the support. James Hollywood Herrera, I'm thinking about you, my friend. Thank you very much. PB, thank you. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, who showed up last night. Boy, did he ever. Hey, Paul, thank you. Night Stalker, Nayef, Al Safar, Big B, Brian Becerra, Killshot, Keith Hart, Out of Control, Cody Thomas, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eicher, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, John Raging Mad Riffle, Daredevil, Doug Lippert, Ms. Madness, Michelle Mills, Road Warrior, Roderick Welch. Thank you for the dono and the $50 super chat that came in after the Dynamite stream ended on Wednesday night. I did see that. Luke in Arizona could use some prayers and positive thoughts for his mother right now. So let's throw some positive vibes his way. Luke, I'm thinking about you. And the real Maharaja, Binder Singh, dropped the bomb on the show that I was not expecting. I thank him for that. But he also has a very important message he wanted to share with all of you. That if you do not like the way you feel or the way you look, don't think about doing something about it, just do it. He's always struggled with his weight, never did anything about it. 6 weeks ago, he started feeling worse than usual. Turns out his blood pressure was sky high for a 29-year-old with a kid on the way. And he realized that he was responsible now for more than just himself. He wants to be around for a long time for his wife and son, so he started DDPY. Made some other lifestyle changes in terms of diet and sleep. And he is feeling better than he has in a very long time. So get help. Whether it's medical help, mental help, just deciding to help yourself, make that change. His son was born March 3rd. And he is glad that he can make the changes he did and watch his son grow all at the same time. So don't make the same mistakes that he did. If there is someone out there who just needs that little extra push, let his story be it. So, Binder, I'm glad that you're doing well. As somebody who's done DDPY before, it's a great program. And congrats on the new addition to your family. You will not be getting as much sleep for a while, or so I'm told. But don't let that knock you off the wagon. Let's start out here with WrestleMania Night 1. It is in the books. And I will say that if tonight is anything like last night, this will go down as one of the greatest WrestleManias of all time. That's how good I thought night one was. Night two has a tough mountain to climb. And we made history last night because for the first time ever, we had a tag team championship match closing WrestleMania. And only the second time in history that a tag team match closed out the show, period. The first one being the very first WrestleMania Madison Square Garden, but never for the tag team titles. Kevin Owens now enjoys back-to-back WrestleMania main events. For Sami Zayn, I mentioned it last night, he was in a mousetrap being pinned by Johnny Knoxville a year ago. And then the Bloodline story developed the way that it did, and who could have predicted that he would be in the spot that he's in right now? But he just main evented his very first WrestleMania, so for all the people who were worried about Sami and everything coming out of Elimination Chamber, and I know people think he should have won the title, so it's not necessarily a case where everybody was worried about him dropping off the face of the earth. But there were people who I think thought, well, that's the end of the run for Sami Zayn, and he'll be relegated to the, you know, middle of the show, or he won't be doing anything important at WrestleMania. It's just a tag team match. Who cares? If built up properly, it can matter. And as we saw last night, this will go down as one of the best tag team matches that this company has ever produced. And it is the biggest tag team championship match the WWE has ever done. Now, there may have been better matches in the ring, bell to bell, but there has never been a bigger tag team title match than the one that this company produced last night. And Triple H at the post-show press conference talked about the decision to go with the tag team match in the main event. He said, it's all about what is the most impactful. And as storylines played out heading into WrestleMania, to me, it was the most emotional and story-driven match on the card. I felt like that needed to be. I think that we all felt like that needed to be in that spot. Whatever story has the most impact and is the most driven, that is what needs to be in that spot. And in this case, it was the Usos and Kevin and Sami. It's exactly what I've been saying. For that reason alone. Biggest story, best story this company has told over the last 6 to 9 months. How could this not go on last? If it was only one night of WrestleMania, this wouldn't even be a debate. It would be Roman Reigns, obviously. You know, the top dog, he would be in that spot, but you got two nights. But the story was there. It only made sense to close out the show with these four guys. And they had an excellent match. I love the, you know, they had that shot of Sammy before he delivered the final kill shot to Jey Uso, and it always had to be that way. It had to be Sammy being the one to hit the Huluva kick and pin Jey Uso. And he kind of had his little Shawn Michaels, I'm sorry, I love you moment from his match with Ric Flair, WrestleMania 24. I think at one point he even whispered into Jey's ear, and maybe it was after the first Huluva kick because he gave him three, but he said, I'm sorry, Uso. But they had, before the final kick, Sammy was in the corner and they had that close-up shot of Sammy's face. And it's just this feeling of just calm that washed over his face, kind of closed his eyes for a second, took a deep breath. We've seen that expression on his face before. We saw it when he won the NXT Championship for the first time. We saw it, you know, that great match that he and Kevin Owens had at Battleground many years ago, which was the best match the two of them had against each other in WWE. It's this moment of like clarity, and he sold it great. He hit the third Huluva kick. He got the winning pinfall, and Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn are the new undisputed tag team champions. It had some of that John Cena spot calling at the very end, but that aside, like I said, I love that main event, and I went back and I watched the finish again after the show was over. I want to give him credit because I thought it was a good call. I missed the Bloodline Be Damned call by Michael Cole at the finish, which I thought was great. The Women's Championship match with Charlotte Flair and Rhea Ripley obviously did not go on last. And you could tell by the look on Charlotte's face when she came out that she was not happy about that. And I'm sure both of them were disappointed when they got the word that they were not going to be going on last. After, you know, billing it as the main event, even in the little Stranger Things parody with Rhea, there was a mention of her being in the main event of WrestleMania this year. Triple H made the call that he made. He made the right call. And I'm sure they were very disappointed in what these two women went out there and did is basically what Undertaker and Batista did at WrestleMania 23. They were pissed. when they found out their World Heavyweight title match was not closing the show. They were going to be in the middle. And the spot was going to John Cena and Shawn Michaels. So they decided to go out there, and they had their working boots on, and they went and stole the show. And they had a kick-ass match, and that's what these two women did last night. Charlotte and Rhea went out there, and they had the best women's match all year in WWE, one of the best women's matches in the history of the company, especially when you consider the scale of it, right? Being on a WrestleMania in front of 70-plus thousand people. But I have it as the best women's match all year, even better than the Mercedes and Kyrie match at Battle in the Valley, which I thought was fantastic. But it's also just one of the best matches of the year. You know, it was a little slow going at first, but then it built. There was some, you know, good close near falls in there, but just the back and forth between the two of them, it felt like a battle. And in the end, Rhea pinned her with an avalanche riptide off the ropes. And everybody, of course, loved the finish because even when Rhea came out, she got cheered like a babyface. Noticeable boos for Charlotte, but these two women, they went out there and they killed it. And now Rhea Ripley is the SmackDown Women's Champion. We'll see what that means for the future of the Judgment Day since they're a Raw faction. But this was great. You know, if you want to look at it as two co-main events, they both delivered, you know, in spades. The other match I was most looking forward to was Rey Mysterio against Dominic Mysterio. And I'll talk about the Hall of Fame in a little bit as well. I loved everything about this. I loved it from the moment that Dominic made his entrance as the ex-con coming into the corrections van and wearing his father's old mask from Halloween Havoc 97. Rey coming out in the lowrider being driven by Snoop Dogg. He got three different theme songs for one entrance, right? He had the Snoop song, then he had Eddie Guerrero's theme song. Watching Rey come out in the lowrider to Eddie's theme was, that was something. And then, of course, Rey got his own theme song at the end there. But the entrances, the match itself, the drama at ringside with Rey's wife and Dom's sister, Judgment Day getting involved, Legado del Fantasma coming down to kind of counterbalance that. They're in their LWO t-shirts. We have the LWOs back. And in the end, Rey Mysterio beats his son, which everybody loved. The fact that Rey Mysterio beat his son in what was the Cinnamon Toast Crunch match at WrestleMania. So, I guess you would call it the most kid-friendly match, if that's the case. In the Cinnamon Toast Crunch match, we had the father beating his son. What is more American than that? But no, I loved it. I thought it was great. Second best story in the company outside the Bloodline. Dominic has been fantastic in this. Rey, of course, is always fantastic when he's healthy, and he's been able to stay healthy. Even as he's gotten older, he seems to be in better physical shape now than he was 10 years ago when, you know, he couldn't seem to stay healthy with his knees. So I love this match. Obviously, this is not the end of the feud. This program is going to continue. I'm sure there's going to be some sort of tag team match in Puerto Rico at Backlash next month. And I even, you know, was talking about the possibility of there being a singles match at SummerSlam that they could build to. Possibly hair versus mask. I still feel like Dominic growing that mullet out is for a reason. But I could also see him winning in a match like that. You know, if Rey did make the decision that he wanted to hang it up, but it sounds like he's not really thinking about that until maybe he turns 50, which is still a few years away. Hair versus mask. Or some sort of hair match involving Dominic. I could definitely see that down the road. But this was fantastic. The women's trios match with Becky and Lita and Trish against Damage Control was not fantastic. It was fine, but definitely one of the weaker parts of the show. Seth Rollins and Logan Paul, they went out there, had an excellent match. On his podcast, Logan Paul said that his contract is up with WWE as of April 1st, as of the match with Seth Rollins would be the last match on his contract. Now, he tweeted pictures signing his contract. It was June 30th of last year. And ESPN at the time called it a multi-event deal that would extend into the following year. So apparently those multiple events extended as far as WrestleMania. But in an interview with Ariel Helwani the other day, Logan confirmed that his contract expires as of April 1st. And when he was asked if there was any chance that this is going to be it for him in WWE, he said, "I feel like it's unlikely. I'm a good employee." And he said the subject of a new deal has been brought up, but doesn't have one yet. He said he would, of course, like to continue. Said, last year at this time, I had no idea I was going to be a full-time or even, like, almost full-time wrestler as, like, a staple of my career. And now I am. I mean, let's be honest. They're going to fucking renew my contract. I mean, like, come on. It would be silly not to. I agree. It would be silly not to. Every time this guy goes out there on a big stage in a big match like this, he delivers. And Triple H at the press conference last night said what I said on the stream even before that, and what a lot of people have probably said, which is that he has no business being as good as he is in the ring with only a year of experience doing this. You know, this last night was only, what, his third singles match, I think? Right? He had a tag team match at WrestleMania last year. He was in the Royal Rumble in January. Otherwise, he had the SummerSlam match with Miz, Crown Jewel with Roman Reigns, and now WrestleMania with Seth Rollins. And every time he goes out there, it's, look, one of the most entertaining parts of the show. I love that match last night, so I think they would be nuts not to want to extend his deal and bring him back to do more, especially now that he's a heel. You know, as a heel, he's in his element. He's in his zone. It took them this long to figure that out. The men's showcase match, also excellent. Chad Gable's rolling German to Braun Strowman should be on the highlight reel for this show when both nights are over. That was fantastic. But everybody in that match deserves kudos. I loved it. I thought it was great. I doubt very seriously the women's four-way is going to be quite as good as the men's, but I guess that's for them to go out there and prove me wrong tonight. We'll see. But the men's showcase was excellent. Street Profits get the win. No mention of them being in line for a tag team title shot, but why wouldn't they be? John Cena and Austin Theory. This was John Cena's first promoted, announced singles match at a WrestleMania since WrestleMania 31 in 2015, where he won the United States Championship from Rusev. You know, Cena's got history with that U.S. title at WrestleMania. The last time he opened a Mania was WrestleMania 20, his first one. Opening match, Madison Square Garden against The Big Show. And he won the U.S. title. WrestleMania 31, won the U.S. title. WrestleMania 39, here he is back again in the opening match, challenging for the United States Championship. This time he was not so lucky. Now, Austin Theory used a low blow before he hit his finish and he got the win. He took a shortcut to get the win. I don't have an issue with that because he is a heel. And also because after what John Cena said to him in that promo a few weeks ago, he made fun of Theory's balls. Remember when he bopped him in the balls at the end of the promo and he went to go walk away and Cena stopped and he turned around and he goes, yeah, you need to work on that last part, right? He basically said the man has no balls. So Theory just gave it right back to him, right in his balls. And he got the win. Now, it may not mean what it used to beat John Cena, because a lot of people have done it at this point, but a win is a win. It's still a win over John Cena at WrestleMania. You know, Theory is going to be just fine. My issue with the match was not how he won so much. My issue was how average the match was. It was a television match at best, and not a very good one. That was the issue I had with it. But one of the few, honestly, issues that I had with this show. The stage was beautiful. They did a tremendous job on that. I can imagine how it must look in person. I mean, I remember walking into the stadium in Orlando for WrestleMania 33. We were trying to look for our seats. And I got that first shot of the stage with the roller coaster and everything. And I was just blown away. And I would still say this stage is second best only to WrestleMania 33. That's still, I mean, I gave that a 10 out of 10. You know, there's no topping that one. But it should be. It should be the best stage they ever did back in 2017. They spent $5 million on it. So yes, it should be the best stage they ever did. But this one is great too. Just, you know, just a great setup, a great, you know, fun night. Now we go to night two tonight. And of course, I will be back on YouTube Live when the show is over to wrap it all up and talk about everything. Nick Khan had promised surprises for WrestleMania this year. Pat McAfee was one of those surprises last night. He beat The Miz in an impromptu match. So what are the other possible surprises? Well, you know, The Rock posted a message on Twitter which I did not see until after I was done reviewing last night, because somebody asked me about The Rock, and I said, nah, I don't think he's going to be there. Then I go and I see The Rock posted this long video message, probably from his gym, on Twitter, and he talked about a bunch of different things and wishing all the guys and gals, you know, good luck, and he mentioned his daughter making her debut on the NXT show. But he said there was a tease in there of potentially him seeing the Bloodline in person sometime down the line. And it makes you wonder, the timing of him posting that, timing of him saying that, they are in Hollywood, Nick Khan's talking about surprises, it's possible. It's possible. But we have, of course, the main event tonight, the match of the weekend here, is Roman Reigns defending the undisputed WWE Universal Championship against the American Nightmare Cody Rhodes, 1 year after Cody made his triumphant return to the company, beat Seth Rollins at WrestleMania, went on Raw the next night, and told his story, and said that his job in coming back is to try to finish the story that his father started. And he ended up getting hurt, the pec tear, Hell in a Cell, wrestled the match anyway, right? That gutsy performance there. And then he went away. And it was the Triple H comeback of him rehabbing the injury, trying to make it back for the Royal Rumble. And he did. And Gunther beat the crap out of him in the last 10 minutes of that match, but found a way to win. And now here he is in his first WrestleMania main event. I have Cody Rhodes winning the championship tonight. I think this is going to end up being a very bad weekend for the Bloodline, but I am a lot less confident in saying that than I would have been a few weeks ago. Now, I always expected the Usos to lose. It wasn't a shock to see them lose the tag team titles last night. But it does kind of feel to me like maybe, you know, again, they want to tell the story that Roman is angry, paranoid after what happened last night. This could be a very bad weekend for the Bloodline. And then in the end, he finds a way to win. Very possible. Very possible that Roman Reigns is going to walk out tonight, his third straight WrestleMania main event, victorious. No heel in the history of this company has ever closed three straight WrestleManias with a win, unless you consider what somebody mentioned to me the other day, which is actually a valid point. Hulk Hogan was never really a babyface. Hulk Hogan was always a heel. So if that's the case, then I guess Hogan would be the guy. But no, I mean, that's never happened before. That they have sent the crowd home with a heel going over in the main event. But this is, again, a championship run in this era, in this generation. Especially with people in their short attention spans, where we haven't seen anything like this. We haven't seen anything in this company like this since Hogan's run in the 80s and Backlund and Bruno. And those runs, I mean, we're talking 5, 6, 8 years, right? That'll never be topped. But could Roman Reigns go a few more months and hit 1,000 days? Could Roman Reigns drop the championships at SummerSlam at Ford Field instead of doing it tonight at WrestleMania? Yes. This Bloodline story is not over. Especially the story with Roman and Jey Uso. And this story is far from over. I don't think the story has to be told with Roman still having the belts for the next 6 months. I feel like he's beaten so many different people. WWE has something in Cody. Cody has gotten over. He's stayed over. The crowd hasn't turned on him. I'm sure they will once he wins the title. That's usually what happens with everybody. But the crowd has been with him. All right, he's been moving numbers for them. And you run a very big risk of taking a lot of the piss out of this guy if he fails tonight to close the story that he keeps telling us about. And Roman just beats another and just continues on his run. I'm not going to sit here and say that I would hate the decision. If Roman wins, I'm fine with that. If Cody wins, I'm fine with that. But what I like about it is not a predictable finish going into tonight. Anybody who says, oh, I know, Roman's definitely winning, they don't know what the fuck they're talking about. Nobody can tell you for sure that they honestly know who is walking out of this main event tonight with those championships. And I like that. Keeps you guessing, keeps you wondering what decision is Triple H going to make. But I think the right decision would be to crown a new champion and give Cody the ball to run with. And let's see how far he can go with it. Now we have Bianca Belair defending the Raw Women's Championship against Asuka. They have a tall order ahead of them if they want to top what Charlotte and Rhea gave us last night, but it'll be fun to watch them try. The buildup has been absolute dog shit. But as we saw with Charlotte and Rhea, once the bell rings, you could try to make people forget about that Bianca has had a couple of excellent WrestleMania matches in the last couple of years against Sasha, last year against Becky. We know what Asuka can do. It's been a while since we've seen Asuka go out there and have, you know, an excellent singles match. She hasn't really had the chance to go out there and show what she can do in a very long time. You know, tonight's going to be her opportunity. Her biggest WrestleMania match since the match with Charlotte at WrestleMania 34. Gunther puts his Intercontinental title on the line against Drew McIntyre and Sheamus in a triple threat match. This right here. You talk about the ability to steal the show or steal the weekend. For all the great stuff we saw on night one, this right here may be what I am most looking forward to on night two. This should be Sheamus' crowning moment when it comes to him finally winning the Intercontinental title. What a great moment that would be. As far as where you do this match, I was thinking about how you position this match on the show. I don't believe they've announced what's opening the card tonight. I do think this would be a fine choice, though, to open the show, even though it makes it more difficult for the people who have to follow them. I'm still sticking with Sheamus, though. You know, just like in the women's title match, I'm still sticking with Bianca. I think I forgot to make my prediction there. But I'm sticking with Sheamus walking out with the Intercontinental Championship. I see much bigger things ahead for Gunther. Possibly a King of the Ring win. Possibly he could be the top champion by this summer. There are bigger things than the Intercontinental title in this man's future. Now, Mike Johnson had a story on PW Insider the other day that the word making the rounds in Los Angeles this weekend is that Drew McIntyre's WWE deal is coming to an end this year, and the two sides have yet to come to terms on a new one. Now, his deal is not said to be up imminently. It's not like his contract is up in a month or two. But the two sides are not anywhere close to terms on a new deal. Drew's been a workhorse for that company now for years. I feel like I've read at least two or three different stories over the past year alone of him being extremely sick. You know, whether it was food poisoning or the flu or whatever it was, at the building, still going out there to work, still doing all the media, still putting the work in. And he goes out on TV and you would never know anything was wrong. He's out there doing his thing. I see Mike Johnson talking about the fact that Drew was near death backstage before the show. This guy goes out there, he goes to work, and he does the deal. He got a raw deal during the pandemic era. And the Thunderdome shows, and even before the Thunderdome, when they had nobody and nothing, no screens or anything, when they finally put the championship on him. And I thought he did a fine job of carrying things, but by the time they got fans back in the buildings, his run was over. You know, he had the big match with Roman Reigns, a Clash at the Castle. It would have been a huge moment for him had they given him the title there, but it would have been premature to take the title off of Roman Reigns. Especially if you look back at that now, and all that has happened in the Bloodline story since Clash at the Castle, I mean, just the Sami Zayn stuff alone, and you realize what a mistake that would have been to take the titles off of Roman Reigns in September. It just was not the right time. But they would be crazy not to keep him. I'm sure WWE is going to want to do everything in their power to keep Drew McIntyre. It sounds, again, it's still very early. I'm sure they will end up making a deal. But if they didn't, I mean, look, there's not going to be any shortage of promotions wanting to bring this guy in. I mean, he would not be hurting for work. We have a Hell in a Cell match. It is Edge, one-on-one against the Demon, Finn Balor. It was a mixed bag for the Judgment Day last night. Dominic lost, Rhea won. This is a match that Finn Balor should win. You know, Edge and Beth Phoenix went over on him and Rhea at Elimination Chamber in Montreal. This is a match where we have not seen the Demon character. We have not seen Balor with the Demon body paint since that embarrassing finish a couple of years ago to Roman Reigns. Edge does not need this win. You know, this is a win that the Judgment Day should pick up. I'm more interested in seeing the entrances for this match, to be honest with you. And some of the rumors I've heard about Edge's entrance, having a brood tie-in of some kind. I mean, we'll see. But Balor should definitely, I think, pick up the win here. And then we have, the match of the weekend that I know everybody is looking forward to. It is the Irresistible Force meeting the Immovable Object. It is Brock Lesnar, one-on-one with Omos. The shorter, the better. If I had to make a prediction on how long the match goes, it can't go more than 5 minutes, I wouldn't think. Although the Brock match with Goldberg at 33, which actually ended up being very good, that went 6 minutes. But yes, this should not be going very long. The entrances, especially with that long ramp, are probably going to be longer in total than the match itself. Look, this all comes down to Brock's future in WWE. Been a lot of talk about him coming to the end of his deal. He's going to wrap up with them. This is not going to be Brock Lesnar's farewell match. This will not be the final time we see him in the ring at WrestleMania, I'm sure. But could he disappear for 6 months, 9 months, a year? Sure. This could be it for him for a while. And if it is, then guess what? Omos is probably going to get the win. I think the outcome of this match is directly tied into what Brock's future is in this company. If he's only going to disappear for a few months and he'll be back by the summer to, you know, be there for Money in the Bank or SummerSlam, I don't see him losing this match. If he's going to be gone a lot longer than that, then I think he'll do the honors. And if they want him to put over Omos, you know, then he'll put over Omos. You know, could we see Bobby Lashley get involved in this match and cost Brock Lesnar a win after what Brock did to him at Elimination Chamber? And could that lead to some sort of Hurt Business reunion and Omos would be involved? I mean, look, sure, it's possible. Unlikely, because we know that Lashley has already issued an open challenge. He's going to be doing his own thing on the show. He better be. You know, he won the Andre Battle Royal on SmackDown the other night, but he better be on that show tonight. So if I had to make a prediction who actually goes over, I think Brock wins. But again, it's tied into his contract status. And then we have the WrestleMania Women's Showcase. Liv Morgan and Raquel Rodriguez against Natty and Shotzi, against Sonya Deville and Chelsea Green, against Ronda Rousey and Shayna Baszler. And speaking of things that could impact the outcome of a match, let's talk about this here briefly, because Ronda Rousey had some very interesting comments on Instagram this past week. That's been going around recently. People have been making controversial comments on Instagram. But Ronda posted a clip from her Ronda on the Road vlog that she does, blasting the booking of her feud with Liv Morgan last year. And she captioned the video with the following: "Imagine what our feud could have been if we weren't hamstrung by a bunch of octogenarians who still think they know how to be hip, while putting less than 5 minutes of thought a week into each women's storyline." Now, for their match at Extreme Rules, they both wanted to do a lot of hardcore type stuff to live up to the name, right? To live up to the stipulation. They had an Extreme Rules match. They wanted it certainly to be more hardcore than it ended up being. They wanted to use thumbtacks, you know, that kind of stuff. And they were turned down. WWE does not do a lot of that stuff anymore. They'll use kendo sticks. They don't care if you have bloody, bruised, disgusting welts all over your back and chunks of flesh missing. That's okay. So kendo sticks and all that stuff are fine, but thumbtacks and barbed wire, right? We don't see them doing that anymore. In AEW, it's called Wednesday. But this is not AEW. But she made the octogenarian reference. The Extreme Rules match came months later, though, when Vince McMahon would not have been involved in that. Vince was still head of creative when Liv cashed in her Money in the Bank on Ronda. And when they had their match at SummerSlam, Vince, he wasn't there, but it was still his show. It was largely already booked before he left. But Extreme Rules would have been Triple H's show. So, look, who exactly is she referencing beyond Vince? I know Michael Hayes and Bruce Pritchard, they're no spring chickens, but I'm not sure who else she would have been referring to other than Vince with the octogenarian reference. I mean, maybe she just lumped all three of them together because they've been there for 1,000 years. I know Bruce was gone for a while, but still, he's been there for 1,000 years. Ronda Rousey, I can't believe I'm saying this, but Ronda Rousey is not wrong. I don't think you need thumbtacks, but the larger point that she is making is not incorrect. And coming out of this weekend, Triple H has a lot of work to do to rehab that women's division because it is something that he needs to address. And yes, you can call up one or two new faces from NXT, and I think that will happen. But you could call up 15 different women. You can call up the entire fucking NXT women's division. It's not going to matter if the booking doesn't change and the focus doesn't change and they can't come up with compelling stories for the women the way that they've managed to do for some of the men. That is going to be something that Triple H needs to put some thought and effort into coming out of this weekend. But will Ronda's comments have an effect on the outcome of this match? Because this seems like a no-brainer that Ronda and Shayna are going to come out of this as the winners. Probably would have gone on to win the tag team titles from Becky and Lita. Does this change things now? Her going and insulting creative so publicly and making those comments, does that change the outcome here? Very possible. Yeah, WWE doesn't like it when you speak out of turn like that. So I'm still going to stick with Ronda and Shayna, but if they don't win this match tonight, then it has to be tied into the comments that Ronda made. Wrestle Rumble, by the way, is having its classics contest tonight. Very excited about this. You can still enter right now here on Sunday. It's only $1 per entry. Third place winner goes home with a classic Intercontinental Championship replica belt. Second place takes home a Winged Eagle dual-plated title. And the first place winner gets two classic tag team championship belts. The cutoff time to enter is tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern. I will be hosting the random drawing to pick those three winners live during my night 2 WrestleMania review, because who needs sleep? So we'll be doing that contest toward the end of the stream, most likely. But go to WrestleRumble.com right now. You can enter the contest. Again, it's only $1 to enter. You can enter as many times as you like. And we'll give away some gold. There's some gold out there up in them there hills. So that's coming up tonight. Now, Nick Khan was on the March End and Hour End sports media podcast, and he talked about a lot of things, a lot of media-centric things, which he's very knowledgeable about, and how media rights are going to shake out for other sports leagues. A lot of boilerplate-type stuff where, you know, his time in WWE is concerned. But two things he talked about. On Vince McMahon, he claimed that he is not that involved on the creative side. Now, Triple H has said that he still talks to his father-in-law about creative, and Vince makes suggestions, maybe he pitches ideas, but that Triple H, he says, has final say on all matters related to creative. But I do love how things have evolved from January. When Nick Khan was asked that same question, he said Vince was only back to engage in exploring strategic alternatives. His involvement on the creative end, he said at the time, was zero, none. Fast forward to March, now it's, well, he's not that involved. We'll check back in May and see if he gives a different answer. Look, Vince McMahon is going to do what he wants to, so long as he owns the company. Vince McMahon is going to do what Vince McMahon wants to do. There isn't much anybody can do about it. So long as Triple H is there to at least balance him out, it is still a better situation than things were when Vince was the sole voice that mattered. And matches would be advertised and then changed the day of because entire scripts were being rewritten 2 hours before the show. And we would get constant rematches on television all the time. If that starts to change, if we start seeing constant rematches again on TV, then that would be a bad sign. Vince McMahon is at WrestleMania this weekend, which should not be a surprise. Not only is he at WrestleMania, he's got his own office near the gorilla position, and he was on headset last night for the first time since July. I'm sure all the production people were very happy about that. He was back on headset. He was giving feedback. He was asking questions. Why are we saying the word wrestling so much? McMahon is officially a WWE employee again, according to a new filing with the SEC. He entered into an employment agreement with the company on Thursday and will continue to serve as executive chairman of the board for 2 years, retroactive to January 9th. The agreement also gives him full rights to his name and likeness and his life story in perpetuity. So he now has the exclusive right to license or exploit his life story in any way that he sees fit, whether it's through books, movies, documentaries, television shows, a Broadway show. Just imagine McMahon on Broadway. And so I told my daughter, you know, it's a great idea. We'll reveal that I'm actually the father of your unborn child. It'll be great. Maybe he'll start doing these one-man stage shows like Undertaker's been doing, since those have been so successful. One other thing that Nick Khan talked about that caught people's attention is when he was asked about the possibility of WWE's big shows returning to a pay-per-view model. And this is kind of deceiving as far as how certain websites reported this in the headlines. This was not something he said they were actively looking to do. He got asked a question about whether or not he would be open to conversations about following the model the UFC has with ESPN Plus for its pay-per-views. He said they were, and that if, say, NBC Universal offered 5x in rights fees to them on their next rights deal, but they needed to have what's called an upcharge in order to do that, like, we'll pay you all this much more money for you know, your media rights, but we're going to want to charge a fee for these big pay-per-view shows, he said that they would be happy to listen to their proposal. What that means is, let's say NBC Universal got the rights to everything, right? They could, as part of such a deal, they could charge 50 or 60 bucks per show for all of the pay-per-views, or maybe just for the bigger shows like WrestleMania, Royal Rumble, SummerSlam. ESPN has the rights to UFC, so if you subscribe to ESPN Plus, and I think they charge 10 bucks a month for the service, you can buy the UFC shows for an additional fee. In fact, they just raised their pay-per-view prices again a few months ago. Now I think these UFC shows are up to like 80 bucks per show, which is ludicrous, especially some of these cards they put together. WWE could end up doing the same thing, although I doubt it would, you know, they would charge anything close to $80 for each pay-per-view. But Khan said the most important thing is not to price out their fans. They're conscious of not wanting to price people out. He even pointed out that I think the cheapest seats at WrestleMania this weekend are 25 bucks, you know, up in the cheap seats. You know, look, it's tough. It's tough to go from paying 50 bucks a month for their pay-per-views to basically paying nothing for them on Peacock. And then you tell people, well, we're going to go back to the old way of doing things. And we're going to ask you to pay 50 bucks or 60 bucks for those same shows. Are people going to want to do that? A lot of people will. A lot of people won't. You know, as a content creator, if I wasn't doing this show, I would only pay for the... If I had to pay full price for these pay-per-views, I would only pay for the key events. You know, I would not be paying 60 bucks for Backlash. I'm just saying. Although Backlash this year might be a good show. I'm not picking on Backlash. I think Backlash in Puerto Rico next month is going to be a fun show. But just in general, I'm not going to, for some of these B shows, pay the same as what I would for the Royal Rumble or for WrestleMania. That's just not going to happen. Now, the WWE Hall of Fame aired on Peacock the other night. Immediately after SmackDown, it was filmed in the arena as soon as SmackDown went off the air. So they had a sold-out crowd there. Mick Foley and Tori Wilson inducted Stacy Keibler, who had a very nice speech. She had pictures of her up on the Titantron from when she was a fan. She was in the crowd at Nitro. I think the story is that her boyfriend was a wrestling fan at the time. And so anyway, there's pictures of her at Nitro back in the day and some of the WCW shows. But they showed a picture on the Tron of her in the crowd with a WCW Monday Nitro shirt on, holding up a giant pink sign that said, "Thank you, Brett," for Bret Hart. I know she was in the crowd for a Nitro in 97 and for, I think, Starrcade in 98. I saw people shitting on her induction, just the speech and how, you know, I guess how positive it was. I don't know what their issue with it was. I didn't see anything wrong with it. I thought it was a very nice speech. Stacy has been out of the spotlight for a while. She's got a bunch of kids now. She's been doing the mom thing. I don't know what she's been up to. In fact, I think she just broke her social media silence the other day. I don't think she had tweeted anything in like 3 or 4 years. And so now she's reappeared. But she went out there and it was a very positive speech. And she was very complimentary of a lot of people. And I thought it was fine. I didn't see anything wrong with it. It struck me as people shitting on her for no reason. We had the induction of Andy Kaufman into the celebrity wing of the WWE Hall of Fame. Jerry Lawler was not there. But he did send in a video from his home, from his throne, in Memphis. And in the video clip that they aired, he said he asked Jimmy Hart to handle the induction for Andy. I thought Lawler looked good. He can talk. But you can tell that he doesn't sound like himself. Sounds weak. His voice sounds weak, if that makes sense. He is still recovering from a major stroke. So, look, there's a lot of people who suffer strokes who can't speak at all, where they speak with the slurred speech. All things considered, he was looking and sounding pretty good, but you could tell he was not close to 100%, or else he would have been there. So Jimmy Hart came out to do the induction instead. Jimmy Hart continues to be the ageless wonder. I cannot fathom the idea that Jimmy Hart is going to be 80 years old next year. 80. Unbelievable. He talked for a little bit. He has history with Andy. He managed Andy. He wrestled Andy in Memphis. If it wasn't going to be Lawler doing the induction, Jimmy was the next best choice. They brought out Kaufman's siblings to accept the award on his behalf. And they made it very clear that this would be, if he was alive, one of the proudest moments of his life. He loved wrestling that much that he would just be over the moon, right? Man on the moon about this induction. We had Ric Flair doing the induction for the Great Muta, and he managed to make a good part of it about himself. He also made it a point to put Asuka over twice as a badass. He said he puts Muta in the same class as Ricky Steamboat and Shawn Michaels. Muta walked out, and the man has jelly for knees. It was painful watching him walk to the... I have no idea how he wrestled all of those final matches only a couple of months ago. He had like 6 final matches. And I have no idea, including, by the way, a singles match. Because, you know, some of those matches, they kind of hit him. He was in a tag or like a trios situation. But he wrestled Naito in a singles match in the main event of the Tokyo Dome back in February. And then even after that match was over, remember, he called Chono in. And he and Chono had a quick little 2-minute match. I have no idea how he did that. I have no idea. And that match, by the way, with Naito was better than it had any right to be, given the fact that the man can barely walk. He said that his English is not great, so he kept it very short and sweet. He thanked WWE, and then he spit the green mist out and got a huge pop. And they cut to a shot of Asuka in the audience, and she was geeking out like a kid. I thought that was awesome. They had JBL and Ron Simmons doing the Warrior Awards speech for Tim White. No Dana Warrior this year. Is it just me, or does that Warrior Award statue look so tacky and goofy with the Warrior mask? It's like a, it looks like a piece of paper. It's just the Warrior mask taped to this little gold statue. I don't know if it just looks that way or if it literally is taped on. I have no idea, but you would think after all these years, they could at least create a statue in the shape of the Warrior face paint instead of just tacking it on like that. But anyway, JBL warned us that Tim's two brothers would be coming out to accept on his behalf, and that one of the brothers looked identical to Tim White. And he was not joking. His brother could have been his twin. This was very nice. Again, a very well-deserved honor. Hopefully they start recognizing other referees as well. But Tim White, he did so much more than just referee. He did a lot of things behind the scenes for the company that people don't even know about. Even after they fired him. They fired this man in 2009. They let him go. But he would still come back, you know, on WrestleMania weekend and for other big events. Kind of unofficially, he would come in and act as like a talent liaison. And he would help out with things like autograph signings. Even though technically he no longer worked for the company in any kind of official capacity. But he is best known for his work as a referee. That and being Andre the Giant's caretaker and friend on the road. And also the lunchtime suicide skits with Josh Matthews, which were, of course, never mentioned, never shown in his induction video for obvious reasons. But I'll be damned if he didn't make them entertaining. They were tasteless as all hell. But I watched every single one of those lunchtime suicide skits when they first dropped. I couldn't believe what I was watching. But it just, it hits different though in a business where so many people have actually committed suicide. So that's why it was so tacky. But so that was never mentioned. The most famous of all the matches he ever officiated has to be Hell in a Cell, Undertaker and Mankind, King of the Ring 98. He was in there for a lot of classic matches, but I don't know of one that would be more classic that he was in the ring for than that one. Rey Mysterio was the main event. He was the headline inductee on this show. Conan did the induction. There was nobody better than him to do it. He has known Rey since Rey was 12 years old. And Rey would not be where he is today were it not for Conan opening doors for him and later on convincing him to drop out of school to wrestle for AAA when AAA first started up. You know, he called Rey one day and said, look, we're starting this thing up. I want you in and good money, travel. Rey said, I'm in school. Conan said to him, well, how much is school paying you? He goes, nothing. He goes, well, there you go. I'll talk to your parents. Don't worry about it. And the rest is history. Conan did a fantastic job. Ray started speaking, and Dominic, Rhea, and Damian Priest, who were all sitting together on stage with the other talent. Buddy Matthews was there too, with Rhea, although I think once the ceremony started, he must have gotten up and left, because he wasn't there anymore. But yeah, we had two-thirds of the House of Black was at the Hall of Fame on Friday night. Aleister Black was there with Zelina, and we had Buddy Matthews there with Rhea. But we had Rhea, Dominic, and Priest all stood up just as Ray started speaking, and they walked out. And that was the extent to which Dominic kind of interfered with any of this. I enjoyed Ray's speech a lot. You know, he talked about his time wrestling Psychosis. He pointed out Psychosis specifically in ECW, being very helpful in his career, the matches they had. Wrestling Dean Malenko in what was basically his tryout match for the Cruiserweight title at the Great American Bash in 1996. Wrestling Eddie Guerrero at Halloween Havoc 97. Coming to WWE, winning the Royal Rumble, becoming World Heavyweight Champion. And he thanked a whole bunch of people. He thanked Conan, he thanked Paul Heyman, Eric Bischoff, Kevin Sullivan, Dean Malenko, William Regal, Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, Batista, Undertaker, Edge, JBL, Kurt Angle, Randy Orton, John Cena, and of course, Eddie Guerrero. And I enjoyed this a lot. Not the most star-studded class by any means, and probably the smallest class they've ever done, but at least the crowd behaved itself. We didn't have anybody getting attacked like what happened to Bret Hart a few years ago. I am sure Batista would have headlined this year if he was not in South Africa filming his My Spy sequel. So I guess that'll have to wait for another year. They still have some big names. You know, Batista, Rock still isn't in. So they have some marquee names. Jericho eventually will go in, I'm sure. Brock, I don't know if Brock would want to go in, but they still have some names in the next few years that they could induct. This week's episode is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Watching Netflix is like hitting up the casinos in Vegas and only playing the slot machines. Why would you limit yourself? You're not getting the full experience. Did you know that Netflix has different libraries for each country? So what you're watching in Germany, for example, might be different than what you're able to watch here in the US, or there may be a certain movie airing in Belgium that you can't watch in Canada. They have thousands of shows and movies, but without a VPN, you're only getting a fraction of that based on your location. This is why you need ExpressVPN. One of the many reasons why you need ExpressVPN. With ExpressVPN, you can change your online location and spoof Netflix and other streaming sites into thinking that you're in one place when you're actually somewhere else. It's like having one magical power. If you only had one magical power in this world, there's some people I'd like to make disappear, but I can't do that. But if you had one magical power, it's like having the power of virtual teleportation. You're basically beaming yourself from one place to another. I was watching Train to Busan again the other day. I haven't seen that movie in a few years. It's a South Korean kind of like action horror film. I first watched it a long time ago, but it's no longer on Netflix here in the U.S. With ExpressVPN, though, I just opened up the app. I selected Japan as my desired location. I tapped one button to connect, and when I refreshed the page, there it was. So all of a sudden, there's the play button, and I was able to watch the movie. What I love about the service is that it's fast, so I can stream in HD, no buffering, and they have servers in nearly 100 countries, giving me access to tons of shows I otherwise would not be able to access so easily. So be smart. Stop paying full price for streaming services and only getting access to a fraction of their content. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/solomonster. Don't forget to use my link at expressvpn.com/solomonster to get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. John Moxley was a guest on his wife, Renee Paquette's podcast on Tuesday, as he has been before, but this time was a little bit different. Originally, they were going to record the show last week before CM Punk's Instagram comments, but it got delayed by a week. And wouldn't you know, she wound up having something new to ask him about right at the top of the show. Among the things that Punk accused Moxley of was pitching the idea for a Rocky III type storyline heading into their title match at All Out last year, an idea which Punk said he thought sucked, and he admitted that he has never seen a Rocky movie before. which I think is probably more appalling than anything else here. He also accused Moxley of refusing to lose to him, which Punk said he had never experienced before in his career. Moxley did not address either of those things, but he was noticeably irritated. He was pissed off about being dragged into all of this drama. He generally does not comment on things like this. He said, "It's fucking annoying. Just because somebody said some stupid shit on social media, that is not news. But it is. And it ends up with you, it ends up being a thing. I don't want to get dragged into this dumb shit. I could fucking unload on a lot of fucking people right now, but I'm not going to sink to that level." He said that the entire summer last year, he was not under contract with AEW. He was a free agent. He was wrestling Desperado the day of SummerSlam. He could have walked into SummerSlam, he said, that night with the AEW belt if he had been so inclined. The reason he wasn't under contract is because when he got out of rehab at the beginning of last year, right? So this would have been January. His contract was coming due, and the company had extended it due to his time off. And the last thing he wanted to do when he first got out of rehab was sign this new 3-year or 5-year long-term contract. He wanted to ease back into things, see what life was like and how he feels, and make sure that, you know, he's not going to go off the rails with his drinking again. And he realized very quickly that he was a lot happier being sober and working with his friends and doing the Blackpool Combat Club stuff. And he's thinking, you know, look, if everything just stays the way that it is right now, I will be in AEW forever. But he couldn't tell them what he was going to feel like in 6 months, so he was hesitant to sign a contract. He signs a new deal. That's when he starts fighting through injuries and putting pressure on himself to do all of these things that could potentially lead down a bad road for him. And he's just out of rehab. He didn't want to take that chance. And I get that. I understand that. But for Tony Khan to put his world title, interim or otherwise, on a guy that was not under contract is insane. I mean, that is a little too much trust to put into one person, especially after one of his EVPs went to WWE. And I know Cody did business the right way on his way out. He lost the TNT Championship to Sammy Guevara. But still, you know, as somebody who has been vocal in the last, at least the last 6 months, about the ways that WWE has put the screws to him, this is Tony now who has said this, right? He's been very vocal about that. How WWE has screwed him over in certain situations despite him trying to be a nice guy. That was a very dumb thing for him to do. I'm also not sure what the point of Moxley flexing like that was, saying, well, you know, I could have gone to SummerSlam as the champion if I wanted to. Yeah, I'm sure Tony Khan is very thankful that he didn't do that, but Tony also did a very stupid thing for his business. Out of respect for Jon Moxley and his feelings coming out of rehab. And then putting the championship on him as a free agent. Sounds like Tony was a lot more understanding of Moxley's feelings than Vince McMahon would have been, or Triple H would have been. Maybe a little too much so. So it was very odd to hear Moxley throw that out there, like, you know, I could have done this and I could have done that, you know, when it sounds like Tony was bending over backwards to keep this guy happy. So that was strange. Moxley then brought up the night in Minneapolis on Dynamite where he wrestled Chris Jericho for the interim title. That would have been the Quake by the Lake show. That was the night that Punk came back, came down to the ring. He beat up the members of the Inner Circle, and then he went face to face with Moxley in the middle of the ring. By the way, Moxley never mentioned Phil by name. Never mentioned Phil, never mentioned Punk. Not even once, other than referring to him at one point as What's His Dick, when he brought this story up. Instead of saying What's His Face or What's His Name, it was What's His Dick. But he said the night that Punk came back and, you know, he was hopping around on one foot, he said at that point, he basically doesn't work there. You know, Moxley says, I don't work there. Tony Khan is not my boss. I don't have to be here. I don't have to do shit. And even agreeing to a storyline that puts, you know, Punk over at the pay-per-view, I'm bending over backwards for this guy, and I'm bending over backwards for Tony Khan. And again, he didn't address the Rocky III idea. We're not wanting to do a job for Punk. He didn't confirm it. He didn't deny it. He didn't clarify if he wanted to beat Punk on TV first, and only then would he agree to do the job for him at the pay-per-view. He didn't address any of that. He said it's never really been the plan to build things around him, other than when the pandemic happened, the whole world shut down. Then all of a sudden, you know, Tony built things around him. But Punk goes down with a foot injury. Tony calls on Moxley to step in. Punk goes down with another injury a few months later, and Brawl Out happens. And again, what does Tony Khan do? He calls on John Moxley to step in. And Moxley did say, you know, it does get annoying to think if you would have just gone with me in the first place, we wouldn't be fucking going through this again. And I can understand that frustration. I don't think John Moxley is going around backstage every week, banging on Tony Khan's door trying to politic his way into another title run. But after that second time, when all the juvenile bullshit went down, to have your boss come to you and say, hey, look, I need you again, I would feel the same way that Moxley does. You keep telling me, you know, you like these other guys better than you like me, yet when shit goes sideways, you keep coming back to me like an old, reliable pair of sneakers. If you just went with me in the first place, we wouldn't have to keep dealing with this shit. He has every right to be frustrated about that. But he was also very clear to follow up that point by pointing out how happy he is in AEW right now and how good life is for him. He said he doesn't want any negative BS. He said, what is there to complain about? Look at the life I have. Look at my career right now. What's there to complain about? And then came the comment that a lot of wrestling sites predictably ran with as the headline without any context whatsoever. Or if there was context to the quote, it was buried in the fifth paragraph of the story. He did say that as an observer, he spent 8 years on the indies, many more years in WWE, both in developmental and on the main roster. He has never seen so much bullshit drama in one place in his entire life. And he doesn't know if it's the age of social media where shit gets blown out of proportion. One person, he said, drunk tweets something dumb and it all gets blown out of proportion. He said, we're here doing this podcast. You know what we're not talking about? The stellar match that Vikingo and Kenny Omega just had. And all of the cool stuff happening in AEW and this great pay-per-view that we just had. He goes, we're not talking about that. We're talking about some BS. He said, the vast majority of the people in AEW were cool and they don't cause problems. But they're getting sucked down into this shit. So there's plenty of people who just want to perform and get better and do this job. It is the best job in the world. That is one of the big takeaways from the interview. Is that Moxley is loving life right now in AEW. And he said that most of the people there are great. But for a small few that like to basically, you know, in so many words, be drama queens and stir things up. That and the fact that Tony Khan let Moxley work without a contract for months and still put his world title on him. Those were my two big takeaways from this interview. You know, the rest of the conversation was him talking about not wanting to be a coach or a producer in the official sense, but how much of a thrill he does get when he can help out other talent and then he watches them go out and apply it. He said it gives him as much of a rush as he gets when he's in the ring himself. And then taking us through the psychology of his Texas death match with Hangman Page. I'm not going to sit here and tell you I'm a big fan of those types of matches, but it was interesting to hear him talking about what goes through his mind when he's in a match like that. Basically, not much. And I'm not saying the man is dumb. What I'm saying is he doesn't think about things before he goes out there and does it. He just likes to go out and do it. You know, he likes to call it on the fly. He talked about that. He talked about being angry that he got pulled from an OTT booking to work the AEW house show in Ohio a few weeks ago. He promised to make that date up for OTT. He said, look, I love working a house show 90 miles away from my house, but I hate having to cancel a booking and then having to make it up to the promotion. But he promised that he would. Renee went and bought a cat, she said, without his approval. He was never a cat guy. Like most people who say they're not cat people and then their wife or their husband buys a cat, you're not a cat person until you get a cat. Then everybody becomes a cat person because cats are fucking awesome. It's one of the only things I use Instagram for, is cat videos. I've officially turned into that person who uses social media for cat videos. I make no apologies for that. So anyway, they got a cat to help chase away some of the mice that they sometimes get. She apparently cannot deal with even the thought of there being a mouse in the house. Moxley pointed out to her, you do realize that one day that cat is going to catch a mouse in its mouth and bring it to you in bed as a trophy, all bloody Guts hanging out. So that was one of the more interesting parts of the conversation. I think it was telling how pissed off Moxley sounded when the interview started. You could tell he was very annoyed that he even had to address any of this. Him referring to Punk only as what's his dick was very telling to me. How dismissive he was of him. And how there are probably a lot of other people backstage there who feel the same way. I doubt he's the only one who was annoyed by all of this. That this shit keeps coming up. All these months later, this is still coming up. Wade Keller of the Pro Wrestling Torch said the sentiment in AEW is that Punk is just not welcome back. The wrestlers, by and large, don't want him back. Even the mass majority of them, he said. He would go so far as to say the mass majority do not want CM Punk back after this. Ultimately, it is not their call to make. It is Tony Khan's call to make. If Punk cannot get along with these people because he doesn't trust them, as he was saying on Instagram, right? If he cannot trust the people that he works with, then he should not be there anymore. This is what some people don't understand about the point that I made in my last rant on this whole thing. You can say Chris Jericho is the problem, the EVPs are the problem, get rid of them and keep Punk, he's worth more to the company than they are, but they're not going anywhere. I mean, that's all nice to say, they are not going anywhere. Labeling these people publicly as liars or stooges, that doesn't help matters. If that's the case, then AEW sounds like the worst place for CM Punk to be working. Now, per this week's Observer, Tony Khan had already made the choice to bring back CM Punk, which probably has something to do with the Fightful story this week, that AEW is trying to book the United Center in Chicago for All Out this year, instead of the smaller Now Arena that they usually run. And usually they can fit maybe 10,000 people in that building. In the United Center, they can fit a lot more. You know, when Punk came back on the first dance, they had 15,000 people in the United Center. So, as far as the Now Arena goes, I mean, they outgrew that building 2 years ago. They should be running the United Center anyway. But if Tony thought that he was bringing Punk back, it would make sense to move the show this year into the bigger building. So, one could have something to do with the other. Meltzer said before Punk's Instagram post, an agreement on reconciliation had been reached with Punk and the company already, whatever the hell that means. Then this happened. And now nobody knows what impact this is going to have on that agreement. You know, it could blow up the entire thing now. But Punk wants back in. Dax Harwood did a live version of his podcast in LA on Thursday. It aired on Fight TV. And he said that Punk texted him during the show when he asked him if he had a message that he wanted to relay to the fans. I guess Punk texted back and said, yes, tell them I miss them. Tell them I miss them. I wish I bought them all ice cream. So now we wait and see if Punk torpedoed his chances of coming back. My guess is if he was this close to a return, and Tony Khan obviously clearly wants him back, this is not going to stop him from bringing Punk back. And if he does, on day one, he needs to get all these people in a room together, every single one of them, Punk, the Elite, Jericho, Moxley, all the so-called locker room leaders in this company, and like at a wedding, speak now or forever hold your peace, okay, air it all out. Because this shit can't happen again. All this talk, by the way, Punk coming back with FTR saying that they're going to quit AEW if they don't win the tag team titles from the Guns on Dynamite this week. That's the storyline. That's the stipulation going into Wednesday. I can't imagine that they're going anywhere. Not if they know their buddy is coming back soon. Why would they leave? Right? They would. I'm sure they would love to go after those trios titles. CMFTR. If Dax and Cash have any sense that Punk is coming back soon to AEW, then they're not leaving AEW. Now, the ratings for Dynamite were down this week. And like clockwork, on the Ring of Honor media call on Thursday, Tony Khan announced that he is going to have another major announcement to share on Dynamite this Wednesday. I love it. I love it so much. I love it so much. Even if one has absolutely nothing to do with the other, it's just pure comedy at this point, the way the timing always matches up. So what could it be? It could be the announcement of their upcoming Saturday TV show that's been rumored, right? They trademarked the name AEW Collision back in February, probably for a new television show. It could be, finally, a release date for the Fight Forever game, if that thing's ever going to come out. Or it could be a reference to their long-awaited, long-talked-about debut in the United Kingdom. Tony was on Talk Sports Talk Wrestling podcast just the other day, and he said, that announcement about AEW in London, it is coming very, very soon. I don't want to say exactly when, but believe me, it will be very, very soon. There are a lot of details to work out on such a major event as this, but all of the major details are coming into place. We are very close to having all of the information ready to announce, so it's coming together quickly. People are going to be very excited when they hear about this. Now, I still feel like if you're promoting this for television, it's got to be bigger than, hey, we're coming to the UK. Or, hey, we have a release date now on our video game that we've been talking about for 2 years now. It's got to be something bigger than that. They've already announced Forbidden Door, so we know it doesn't have anything to do with that. I don't think Tony's going to pop up on screen and say, hey, CM Punk is back. So, I don't know. Maybe it does have to do with a new television show. We'll find out on Wednesday. We now know the reason that we haven't seen Bandido on AEW television since his match with Bryan Danielson back in January. His work visa expired. There's been a lot of that going around. His new visa has been approved already, but he still hasn't physically gotten it yet. And Tony Khan said he is expecting him back soon, but there is still no date for when that might be. Dynamite this past Wednesday night was all about establishing the Blackpool Combat Club as the new top heel faction in this company, and the return of the American Dragon, Bryan Danielson. We had Kenny Omega defending his IWGP United States Championship against Jeff Cobb of United Empire. Cobb has been waiting for Kenny since the beginning of the year. He has wanted a crack at that belt. If Kenny's not coming to Japan anytime soon, Cobb said, well, I'm going to come to your neck of the woods and we'll do the match in AEW. And that's what they did on Wednesday. Not nearly as good as the match Kenny had with Vikingo the week before, but it was still good. I enjoyed it. Kenny obviously retains the championship. You're not losing the title to Jeff Cobb when you have a potential rematch looming with Will Ospreay. That would be very dumb. Now, there was a storyline on this show involving Don Callis. In the back, before Kenny's match, he came clean to Omega about what happened in the ring with Hangman Page the week before, when he kind of made it look like Page had knocked him down. He did that exaggerated bump, fell to the mat. I think all Hangman did was just touch him. And he came clean and said, look, it didn't happen the way that you thought it did, and I'm going to go find Hangman right now. In fact, I'm going to apologize to him face to face. And when he did, Hangman got jumped by Moxley, Claudio, and Yuta. And then Moxley looked at Callis, who was still standing there, and he punched Callis in the face. And Don Callis fell to the ground. When the camera panned down, there was a pool of blood on the floor. And Callis was just, he was busted wide open. This was not part of the plan. He was not aware that there was a light stand right behind him. And he got a very nasty gash on his head that required 14 stitches to close at the hospital. They didn't let him leave the hospital until 3 o'clock in the morning because it took that long to get everything sewn up. The doctor allegedly told him that the cut was so deep he could see his skull. That's some horror movie shit right there is what that is. You know, John Moxley was more annoyed by the Punk Instagram comments than we thought, apparently, and he took out his rage on poor Don Callis. So, looks like Don's going to be gone for a while, but after the match was over, so there was no Don Callis out there with Kenny. The match is over, Claudio and Yuta, they come out from the crowd and with Moxley, and they're surrounding the ring. Omega's inside the ring all by himself. All three of them climb up onto the apron when all of a sudden Bryan Danielson's music plays. And people did not seem to realize it was his music at first, but they reacted big when he walked out on stage. He joined Omega in the ring. He was acting like he was disapproving of what his stablemates were doing, even though it's been months since we've actually seen him associate with this group. But Danielson, you know, he's barking at them, stand down, and all three of them drop off the apron to the floor. And Danielson puts his hand out. He reaches down to extend his hand to Kenny Omega, who, you know, understandably is a little bit leery. But he accepted the gesture, and Danielson helped him to his feet. Yuta climbs up on the apron. Omega goes after him, but Yuta drops down to the floor. And when Omega turns back around, Bryan Danielson is there to blast him in the face with the Busaiku knee. Bryan Danielson puts Kenny Omega in the yes lock, while the other three members of the group put the boots to Kenny. And they fought off You know, Nakazawa came out and a few other people, they fought them off as well. The geek security guards, he tried to stop him. All four members of the Blackpool Combat Club celebrating to a chorus of boos. And Brian Danielson got down on the mat, grabbed Omega and yelled at him, "You are everything that is wrong with wrestling." This was excellent. I thought Danielson would take some more time off. So he was back a lot earlier than I expected, but I don't have a problem with them going heel with him, and really all of them, because heel Brian Danielson is just as much fun to watch as babyface Brian Danielson. And it also means getting Kenny Omega against Brian Danielson again. Yeah, I mentioned this the other day, 6 of my 9 match of the year candidates so far. Actually, I have a few more to add after this weekend. But before this weekend, 6 of my 9 match of the year candidates so far involve either Brian Danielson or Kenny Omega. So if we get to see them back in the ring against each other, I think that's fantastic. Now, I figure Will Ospreay is going to take the U.S. title back from Omega at Forbidden Door and bring the belt back to New Japan. But I would love to see Brian Danielson take that U.S. title from Omega and finally get Brian in the ring in Japan for at least a few matches this year. I think that would be great, too. Either one of those guys taking the U.S. title from Omega is okay with me. Now, Matt Jackson of the Young Bucks is out with a partially torn biceps. He suffered early in the trios match with the House of Black and the Jericho Appreciation Society in Winnipeg a few weeks ago. That would explain the ambulance angle that they did with the Bucks. With surgery, he would be out for many, many months. He has decided to forego surgery. He's going to rehab the injury with therapy with the hope that he could come back a lot sooner. Meltzer says the hope is 6 to 8 weeks. Which would get him back in time for Double or Nothing. But if he can't make it back in time for the pay-per-view to do a tag match, let's say with the Elite against the Blackpool Combat Club or even an eventual Blood and Guts match, they have Takeshita on that roster. You know, they have Konosuke Takeshita, who Don Callis has been scouting now for months, who could always offer to help the Elite. And keep this in mind, they did the angle on TV during the MJF feud where Takeshita called Brian Danielson his friend. Right, he's my friend, I idolize this man, he's my hero, and I want him to know that I'm going to have his back, no matter what. Well, that was a couple of months ago. Now Danielson goes heel, Takeshita could feel betrayed by him. You know, they could even have Brian in the Blackpool Combat Club beat him up, and that could give Takeshita a reason to team with Hangman and the Elite. So that, to me, makes all the sense in the world if they needed somebody to step in for Matt Jackson. The other name to keep in mind is Kota Ibushi, is also a free agent right now. In fact, he just returned to the ring this weekend against the Speedball Mike Bailey on the Bloodsport show and against Joey Janela on the GCW show, both of which I watched, both of his matches, I should say. And look, he's been out of the ring for almost 18 months. He's still got it. He looks different. He's less muscular than he used to be, but he's still got it. You know, Ibushi and Yoshihiko. Yoshihiko the blow-up doll and Ibushi were both on the same show Friday night. Old rivals, but they did not wrestle each other this time. You know, Yoshihiko was one of the most over stars of the entire weekend. In fact, I saw my little nemesis from House of Glory, Charles Mason, had a little run-in with Yoshihiko this weekend. But anyway, the history with Ibushi and Kenny Omega. If Kenny needed to call in a favor to a friend. Remember, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? The phone-a-friend. If he had a phone-a-friend, they could get Ibushi in for one or two big matches if they wanted to. I'm sure he would do it. And we also had the return of Adam Cole with a win over Daniel Garcia. They did a not-so-subtle tease at the end of this when Chris Jericho came out to help Garcia to the back. He would never look directly in the direction of Adam Cole, but he kind of turned his head as if he was... You know, he knew Cole was there, and he wanted to make Cole aware of the fact that he knew Cole was there. And it was just one of those things, to plant the seed, and clearly that is going to be the direction that they head in going into Double or Nothing, is Jericho and Cole. And as far as opponents for Adam Cole, you probably won't find anyone safer for him to get in the ring with and work a program with coming off such a big injury than Chris Jericho. Now, speaking of Adam Cole, he was one of the stars of this new AEW reality show. Let me give you just a quick review here for this. I did watch AEW All Access the day after it aired. It airs after Dynamite. It is a 6-episode season. This was the first episode. I don't know if I'm going to stick with the entire 6. This first show was a mixed bag for me. This is where they take you behind the scenes in AEW and they follow a handful of talents. Britt Baker was clear, at least in the first episode. Maybe it'll be someone different in each episode is like the star of the show. But if the first episode was any indication, Britt Baker was the person that they focused on the most and is the real star of the show here. But they also featured Adam Cole, the Young Bucks, Sammy Guevara, and Ty Mello. Britt was positioned, though, as the star and did not always come off in the best light, especially on the Thunder Rosa stuff. There were a lot of scenes with her complaining to other wrestlers backstage about Rosa not being around, and at the time she was still the AEW Women's Champion, and Toni Storm was only the interim champion, and, you know, when Britt was hurt, she worked hurt, or she would still be around and doing things even if she was hurt, and Rosa's not doing the same. She was complaining about Rosa to Rebel, she was complaining about Rosa in another scene with Toni and Saraya. Even if it's all staged, as a lot of these types of things are on these shows, these different scenes of her complaining, she did not come off well here. Just because you're hurt and you want to work hurt does not mean that everybody else should. Right? It's months later now, and Rosa still has not come back to the ring because her injury was so bad, she's doing Spanish language commentary for them instead until she can heal up and get cleared. It just came off like Britt was giving herself a pat on the back at Rosa's expense. She was all but accusing her of faking her injury, which is something she's actually flat out accused her of doing before. And she still stands by that to this day. She has not, you know, taken that back or rescinded that. She still stands by that to this day. It looks from the preview like we're going to be getting Rosa's side of things soon. So I'm curious to see that. In other parts of the episode, you know, Britt was portrayed as the supportive partner to Adam Cole, being there for him as he dealt with his concussion, also dealing with her own back injury, and she was getting injections for it into her back. Apparently that back injury is very real, and it's gotten worse. Now it's sort of spread to her back and neck. Adam Cole came off great. I mean, when does Adam Cole not come off great? He just comes across like the nicest guy in the room. Very likable. Trying to get cleared for Full Gear in November, and then being devastated when he was told that it wouldn't happen. He was worried that he might not be able to wrestle again after those first few months of the concussion, because it was a really bad injury. Even Sammy Guevara came across as likable. But they have not covered any of the trouble yet that he has been involved in. I am assuming that is yet to come. The worst stuff on this episode was the Young Bucks. They showed footage of them winning the Trios titles with Kenny Omega at All Out. And then Tony Khan's announcement on TV that Wednesday about stripping them of the titles, which is when they were suspended. No mention whatsoever of what they were stripped and suspended for. Only that what they were stripped and suspended for, it was some kind of incident. And I forgot if it was Matt or Nick. One of them said, I think Matt said, even if we could talk about it, we don't want to. It was the lowest point in our careers. We contemplated retiring after this. We thought maybe our careers are over. You know, the purpose of a show like this, as with something like Total Divas, right? It's two-pronged. It can serve to get existing AEW fans more invested in what happens on Dynamite and Rampage every week, and you have more time to flesh out some of those stories. But it also serves to try to bring in new fans who don't watch wrestling. And they don't know who any of these people are. And if you did not know about Brawl Out and the media scrum, you're watching this probably going, what the hell are these guys talking about? What incident are they referencing? Why were they, you know, out of the ring for 2 months? They talked about how, oh, we've been out of the ring for 8 weeks. We've never been out, you know, for this long before. Like, even if they weren't allowed to discuss it, the fact that they gave no context to any of this just made all of this come off very awkwardly. Even more so when we have to listen to Matt and Nick talk about how long it's been since they've been out of the ring. Like, dudes, you've been gone for 6 weeks. We have Adam Cole on this same episode talking about being gone for like 5 or 6 months from a potentially career-ending injury. These two are here bellyaching and crying over the fact that they got stripped and sent home for 6 weeks. Meanwhile, don't they have a ring in their backyard? They're talking about how we haven't been able to get in the ring in 6 weeks. I know they had a ring in their backyard at one point. Do they not have that ring anymore? Did they get rid of it? So the Young Bucks stuff was completely fucking lame. The rest of the episode was okay. I'll probably watch the next one. I care less about these sort of pseudo-manufactured stories on these shows, and more about the little minor scenes that we get where we get to see people interacting in the background, you know, backstage. That's the type of stuff that I like to see. There was a scene with Tony Schiavone at ringside. He was letting Sammy know that he would be wrestling Danielson in a 2 out of 3 falls match on the next show. And he starts geeking out. Like, stuff like that, I think, is nice. So, look, I mean, if the show can do decent numbers and bring in some new viewers, then I guess it'll be a success. I don't know how many current stories it's going to flesh out, though, because these episodes are taped months in advance. This is not exactly current stuff here. Friday night, I was talking about SmackDown on YouTube. There was also the WWE Hall of Fame. There were a bunch of independent shows, but there was also a Ring of Honor pay-per-view, and a pretty damn good one, too, especially on paper. Ring of Honor had its Supercard of Honor show out in LA. Very good show. Nigel McGuinness made a surprise return on the pre-show, coming out to do commentary with Caprice Coleman and Ian Riccaboni. It sounds like it's not a situation where he has signed a contract yet or is going to be a constant presence on the show. But if he wants to come back, Tony Khan, I'm sure, is going to want to keep him around. He was very happy, very excited to have Nigel back. Nigel was a part of the heart and soul of that original Ring of Honor brand. So it was great to see him back. You know, NXT commentary has not been the same since he and Mauro Ranallo were replaced. So that was very cool to see him back in ROH. Fightful said the original plan for the show before he got hurt was for Will Ospreay to wrestle Takeshita. And I kind of wish I didn't know that, because now I'm pissed that we didn't get to see it. But we got a pretty good match with Takeshita beating Willie Mack on the pre-show. As far as the main card goes, Vikingo and Commander opened the show for the AAA Mega title, and it was exactly what you would expect from these two. They delivered as advertised. It was a total stunt show. But as that goes, you won't find two guys better at it these days than these two. And Vikingo, of course, walks out the winner because he ain't losing that AAA Mega title. He's got a rematch he's got to have at some point with Kenny Omega. Can't take the title off him now. The Embassy retained their 6-man titles over AR Fox, Blake Christian, and Metalik, which surprised me, given all the news about Brian Cage. I don't know that his contract status is any different than what we've read about, but he won the match. Not only did his team win, he got the winning fall, and he is still a champion in Ring of Honor, so obviously he's sticking around at least for a little while longer. Samoa Joe retained his television title over Mark Briscoe. I think this was probably the most shocking outcome of any match on the show for a lot of people. I don't see it as a situation where, oh, Tony Khan made a big mistake and what are you doing? I think it was done for a reason. I think that there are bigger plans for Mark Briscoe. And the plan that I had talked about weeks ago had nothing to do with the television title. It was him trying to go after the Ring of Honor World Championship, which is the title that Jay Briscoe held on 2 different occasions. Claudio is the heel champion right now. And I think the bigger story is Mark Briscoe not going after Joe for the TV title. It's going after Claudio for the world title. So I do think that this is part of a bigger plan here. So I don't have a problem with that. We had Tanahashi against Daniel Garcia. This was added at the last minute. Only a few days before the show, Hiroshi Tanahashi beating Daniel Garcia. This was a good match, as you would expect. I know Tanahashi is a lot older. He's not the Tanahashi he was 10 years ago, but it's still Tanahashi. And he still knows how to go in there and work a good match. The Lucha Brothers are the new Ring of Honor World Tag Team Champions. They even had new belts made. They had new belts made across the board. New world title too. But new tag team titles. Hopefully they let Mark keep the old ones. I think that would be appropriate. But the Lucha Bros win the titles. This, unfortunately, was marred by a horrific injury towards the end of the match. Like, right before the finish, in fact. Dante Martin of Top Flight was injured on a very dumb spot involving he and Penta. Penta hit a destroyer off of a bridged ladder in the ring through two stacked tables on the floor. Yes, it was very stupid in a weekend that was full of quite a few dumb stunts, but my only hope is that Dante can heal properly and can come back 100%, because he may not after an injury like this. When he landed, I believe it was his right foot, was twisted in a direction that it should not be twisted in. He suffered a horrific, I assume, ankle break. I don't know if they've officially announced what the injury is, but if you saw it with your own two eyes, it was disgusting, and it sucked the life out of the match for me. Not that there was a whole lot left. Again, this happened towards the finish. But even just looking back on the match now, for all the great stuff we got from these teams, Top Flight, Lucha Bros, Aussie Open, they had a lot of really talented teams in there. Rush and Dralistico. This match now is just marred by this injury. I think it was just, it put a real kind of dark cloud over things, sucked the life out of it for me. Happy to see the Lucha Bros, you know, as tag team champions again, this time in Ring of Honor. I think that's great. But man, that injury was just absolutely disgusting. It reminded me of the Sid Vicious injury in WCW. And that was the worst injury I've ever seen in wrestling. That's what happened to Dante Martin here. And Top Flight, man, they just can't catch a break. They have the worst luck. You know, we had Darius Martin tore his ACL. He was gone for almost a year. He came back. He was involved in a car accident. Had nothing to do with any wrestling matches. And so he was out again for many months. And now Dante with this injury, there's no way he's coming back from this injury anytime soon. I don't know how long he's going to be gone for. It will be many, many months before we see him back in the ring. And so Top Flight, it's just one, you know, bad thing after another. I feel bad for both of them. I feel bad for Dante. But yeah, the Lucha Bros are the new tag team champions. We had Katsuyori Shibata challenging Wheeler Yuta for the Pure Championship. This was good. It's just amazing to me to see Shibata back in the ring wrestling matches again. And they even made fun commentary. They mocked the fact that, you know, he had his... I always look back at that one item in the Observer when Dave said, it's just the way he wrote it, that when Shibata had that horrible injury in the match with Okada in New Japan that basically ended his full-time career, he had to undergo emergency brain surgery. He had like a brain hemorrhage. He could have died. And in the Observer, Meltzer was like, it was so bad they had to take his brain out of his skull. I'm like, what? Did I read that right? I go, Dave, are you serious here, brother? But no, obviously it was a very serious injury, and New Japan would not clear him, and New Japan was not happy when he went into business for himself on, what was it? Was it Wrestle Kingdom? I forgot what show it was. Last year, a year ago, 2 years ago? He went in there. When he got to the ring, he made the announcement, this is not an exhibition. We're doing a match. Well, apparently he didn't tell that to anybody in the back, and they were very unhappy with him about that. So he can't get cleared to have a proper match in New Japan, but he can wrestle elsewhere. And now, not only did he wrestle, he won the championship. He put Yuta down with the sleeper, he hit the PK, and he pinned him to win the Pure title. So this was good. And in the main event, we had Claudio Castagnoli retaining his Ring of Honor World Championship over Eddie Kingston. The fans were totally deflated seeing Mark Briscoe and Eddie Kingston on the same show go in there, challenge for a title, and lose. And they had a very good match. This was a very good main event. We had Shibata coming back out at the end of the show to back up Kingston when it looked like Claudio and Yuta were about to throw down with Eddie, and Eddie was all by himself. Shibata came out, Claudio and Yuta left, and Eddie got on the mic and he made it very clear, and only the way that he can, that this issue with him and Claudio is not over, and he is still going to go after the Ring of Honor World Championship. So, again, a very good show from top to bottom. That Dante Martin injury really, you know, kind of took me out of things there. But one more note on this show. I saw Vladimir the Superfan was in the crowd. In fact, at one point, Mark Briscoe went over and he was hugging Vladimir in the front row. Always good to see Vladimir. The last time I saw Vladimir was in person outside Terminal 5 in August when House of Glory ran there. He came to the show. So Vladimir is in Los Angeles for all of the festivities this weekend. And Mike Johnson of PW Insider is one of Vladimir's best friends. And he posted a very sad update. After talking to him about it, getting his permission to share this, he shared that Vlad has been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. After years, apparently, of doctors trying to figure out like what's wrong with him and get an official diagnosis of what these various health issues mean, because he's been dealing with a lot of health issues now, they finally, I guess, figured out that it is Parkinson's. And for Vlad, his big problem has been his legs are not moving the way that he wants them to. They kind of have a mind of their own. And I guess the reason he gave Mike permission to share this in the first place is because people have seen him around LA at these different wrestling events, and they've spotted him, and they look and see the way he's moving. They think he's drunk. And he wanted people to know, I'm not drunk. I'm not inebriated. I'm just dealing with the effects of a pretty terrible disease. And obviously some days are better than others, but you know, a lot of times it can be hard to control how his body moves. But otherwise, you know, he's doing okay, all things considered. He actually delayed an important surgery that he needs. He pushed it back to next month so that he can be in Los Angeles for WrestleMania weekend because he's a huge wrestling fan. There's a reason why WWE years ago made him the only fan ever to get the designation of superfan, because that is what he is. And he also told Mike to let people know, because he gets asked this question a lot, no, he doesn't know where his documentary is. Release the damn documentary already. You know, Triple H and Stephanie, they presented this guy with a plaque as the company's first officially recognized superfan, and they announced plans for a documentary about the man's life. This was during night one of WrestleMania 37. It's been 2 years. The movie's already finished. It's sitting on a computer somewhere. The trailer for it is still up on WWE's YouTube channel from 2021. And there's been nothing said. There's been no explanation given, apparently to Vlad even himself, about why they decided not to release it. Did they dig up some dirt after the fact that this guy killed 38 people and ate the flesh off their bones or something? I mean, somebody needs to ask Triple H about this at their next post-show press conference. You know, I saw a lot of familiar faces at the press conference last night when the show was over. Maybe one of them can ask Triple H about this. Once this company gets sold, who knows what the hell is going to happen to that thing? I doubt it ever sees the light of day. NXT had its stand and deliver show yesterday at 10 o'clock in the morning LA time. Have some bacon and eggs with your developmental show. Overall, a good show, far below the quality of past WrestleMania weekend NXT shows that they've done. Had a good main event, did not quite live up to the hype that it came in with. A very good brawl with Johnny Gargano and Grayson Waller. A very good five-way match for the North American title. A good ladder match for the Women's Championship. And two tag team title matches that just sort of existed. But we did get a couple of surprise finishes. The first one came on the pre-show, with Chase University beating the Schism. Had they lost, the Schism would have taken control of Chase U, whatever that entails. They've been teasing issues now with Duke Hudson and Chase University for a while. He was the one who made the stipulation in the first place without even consulting Andre Chase. It looked like we were in for a swerve, and he was going to turn against them. We did get a swerve, but not the one that I was expecting. Hudson was having issues with Tyler Bate on their team right from the start. Hudson, later on in the match, ends up seemingly siding with the Schism. He put on a Schism shirt that Joe Gacy handed to him. He got Chance of You Sold Out, until he ripped the shirt off Hulk Hogan style, and Chase University goes on to win. So it was a crowd-pleasing opener. What little we got to see from Ava Rain, you know, The Rock's daughter, she looked fine, but didn't exactly get to see too much out of her. They opened with the ladder match for the NXT Women's Championship with Roxanne Perez defending against Tiffany Stratton, Zoe Stark, Gigi Dolin, Lyra Valkyria, and Indy Hartwell. This was the next surprise of the show. Indy Hartwell backdoored her way into this match in a last chance qualifier. She's had a very rough year where it's just felt like she's been left behind and forgotten about, hasn't been able to find her footing. She's lost a lot of matches. All the other members of the Way have been called up to the main roster. Johnny Gargano, Candice LeRae, Austin Theory, Dexter Lumis, who made a very important cameo in this match. It was not always pretty. These women took some hard bumps, especially Valkyria. Gigi was a fingertip away from pulling down the title at one point when JC Jane appeared out of nowhere, knocked Gigi off the ladder onto a ladder bridge. Tiffany Stratton, who I thought was the star of the match, climbed the ladder very quickly. Hartwell stopped her and tipped the ladder over. Outside the ring, Roxanne, Zoe, and Lyra were standing there. They were supposed to catch Tiffany Stratton. They did not catch Tiffany Stratton. And Tiffany took a brutal flat back bump on the floor. They all sold it anyway, like she wiped them out. They all fell down like bowling pins. So that was scary. Hartwell had the ring to herself, but every time she tried to climb the ladder, she would fall back down. She was holding her ribs. She couldn't do it. She couldn't climb. Until Dexter Lumis appeared outside the ring, and he slid underneath Hartwell, gave her a thumbs up. Then he got her on his shoulders, helped her climb, and Indy Hartwell pulls down the NXT Women's Championship to win the title. I'm happy for her to get her moment. It was cool to see the Index reunion. Good ladder match, unexpected outcome. So instead of taking the title from Roxanne, Tiffany Stratton is going to have to take it from Indy Hartwell instead. Because this title win has transitional champion written all over it. The question now is, does Roxanne get the call up? Or does she get a one-on-one rematch for the title that she was never pinned for? One thing I came away from this match with is that the pipeline of women's talent they have right now is very strong. Sol Ruka is another one. She wasn't in this match, but she's another one. She could be a very big star for them. The future is very bright on the women's side, and we should see a couple of new faces called up to Raw and SmackDown, I think, after this weekend. I think someone like a Zoe Stark would make sense. Roxanne, I could see that. I don't know if we will, but we should get a couple of call-ups. Gallus put the NXT Tag Team title on the line in a three-way match against the Creed Brothers, Tony D'Angelo, and Stax. This was missing something. Yeah, the action wasn't bad, but when it was over, I was expecting more out of this. There was a botched Super Doomsday Device spot on the floor where Mark Coffey had Stax on his shoulders in an electric chair position, when Julius Creed then lifted both of them on his shoulders. Julius is a beast, by the way. Brutus then jumped off the top rope to the floor in the butterball position and totally whiffed. He totally missed everybody. He missed by 5 miles. And they all toppled over anyway to sell it. Vic Joseph said, well, Brutus didn't get all of it. Actually, Brutus didn't get any of it. And the match ended with Joe Coffey, not to be confused with his brother Mark Coffey. That's a lot of coffee. I don't even like coffee. But Joe Coffey returned to break up a pin attempt by Stax. Gallus dropped Stax with their tandem finish, pinned him to retain the titles, and so Gallus is whole once again. I assume maybe that was another one of those visa issues, which is why Joe Coffey has not been seen recently, but Gallus is all back together again. We had the Fatal 5-Way for the North American Championship. Wes Lee defending against Dragon Lee, Ilya Dragunov, JD McDonagh, and Axiom. This was the match I was looking forward to the most on this show. I thought it delivered. All five men showed up. All five men showed out. This was Dragon Lee's debut. He looked good, but he was not the star of this match. The one who impressed me the most, Axiom and Ilya Dragunov. They were the real standouts here. Dragunov is so good. He's so expressive as well, which I'm sure they love, because they're all about, you know, telling stories with your face and getting the close-up shot of your face and showing emotion. He's very good at that. He can be almost to the point of overdoing it, but he's very good with that. But just as a wrestler in the ring, he's phenomenal. I'm very much looking forward to the day they move him to SmackDown and we get the eventual rematch with him and Gunther. And I think it's very sad that so few people watched NXT UK when it was around, when they had their matches together. But when we get to see it on the main roster, if we get to see it on the main roster, those people are in for a treat. I just hope they don't throw him into NXT Europe whenever they launch that, because he deserves a spot on the big shows. Wes Lee ends up winning with the cardiac kick to Dragunov to retain the title. They gave these guys 20 minutes. Excellent stuff. Dragon Lee is still destined to have that championship, I think, by the summer. That is my prediction. As I said last week, very similar to the way they debuted Ricochet in NXT years ago in a multi-man North American title match WrestleMania weekend. He did not win, but he did a few months later. I see Dragon Lee following the same path. We had an unsanctioned match with Johnny Gargano's return to NXT against Grayson Waller. This was a great brawl that took advantage of the stipulation. Waller's back looked like hamburger meat when this was over, as another little piece of Bret Hart dies inside, I know. But I enjoyed this. Candice LeRae was ringside in the front row holding Baby Wrestling, who is going to have quite the video scrapbook to look back on when he's older. Watching his father get the shit kicked out of him outside of their house. Watching his father here get beaten up right in front of him. This was a side of Johnny Gargano we don't usually get to see. This was a personal issue for him to be involved in. It made sense for him to immediately jump Waller from the bell and throw him over the announce desk like he did. Even took out Booker T. Waller was pounding on Gargano in front of his wife, and Gargano hit Waller with a kendo stick before handing it off to Candice, who handed her child off to, I don't know if it was a friend or a nanny or who that woman was with her, but she basically said, "Here, take my child. I have some ass to go kick." She hopped the barricade, started wailing away on Waller with the kendo stick. She did not hold back. She lit this man up. She was peeling chunks of flesh off his back, it looked like. She shattered the kendo stick across his back. Gargano landed the one final beat DDT. Waller kicked out. Gargano locked in the Gargano escape. Waller gouged his eyes to break the hold. There's a spot where Waller put a trash can over Johnny's head. Johnny was on the far side of the ring. And Waller went to the opposite corner, hit an RVD-esque coast-to-coast. That connected, too. He went a long ways. I didn't think he was going to make it. But he cleared the ring. Waller hit Gargano with a chair across the back a few times. Johnny came right back, did the same to him. Waller's back was just so bruised up. And then he put Waller's head in a chair. Took a home run swing with another chair into the chair. And then locked down the Gargano escape for the tap-out win. And Candice celebrated with her husband after the match. Dexter Lumis and Indy Hartwell walked out on stage to embrace the two of them. We got a Way reunion. The Way reunited for one night. Well, I guess Austin Theory wasn't there, but we got most of the old crew back together for at least one more time. So again, this was very good. Waller is going to be sleeping on his stomach for a while after that match. You know, he loses the fight, he wins in the big picture because he just had the match of his life. And you might ask, well, if Johnny is only back for one match, which supposedly this is it, I mean, he's not back on a regular basis, well, then why did Grayson Waller have to lose? Because I think he's headed up to the main roster, that's why. He already challenged twice for the NXT Championship. I mean, what's left for him to do? He's ready. He's got a Miz thing going on with the gimmick, but he's a better in-ring worker than the Miz is. He has the skills to be successful on the main roster. There's no reason not to call him up. NXT Women's Tag Team titles were on the line. Fallon Henley and Kiana James defending against Alba Fire and Isla Dawn. I don't care for the storyline they've been doing for months with Briggs and Jensen and Henley and James. And that's really what this entire match was built around. It seemed pretty clear to me going in that given the issues between the champions, this was designed to get the belts onto Alba and Isla. And that's exactly what happened. All four women were down in the ring. Kiana asked for her purse from Briggs and Jensen. As you know, the one member of this team who has been a heel and is not shy about using heel tactics, she wanted her bag. Jensen wanted to give it to her because he's still smitten with her, but Briggs told him no. And Fallon Henley told him, don't do it, don't give it to her. So he hesitated, and in that moment, that gave the challengers the chance to kick Henley out of the ring, and they hit their finish on James to win the tag team titles. So the match itself, solid match, nothing more than that. It was all about the main event. Bron Breakker defending the NXT Championship against Carmelo Hayes. A match 18 months in the making since they blew up NXT into rainbow colors. These are the two men that they had been really building this brand around. And this was their first one-on-one match. This was a very pro-Carmelo Hayes crowd with noticeable boos for Bron Breakker. This is nothing new. Fans at the PC have been tiring of Braun's run, you know, more and more, and it felt like the right time to do a title change. Was some of the booing due to the incident involving Braun's father at WrestleCon this weekend? For those who don't know, Rick Steiner, both Steiners, were at WrestleCon at a table, I guess. They were signing like a lot of the other legends were. And Giselle Shaw from Impact Wrestling came walking by. And Rick Steiner, completely unprovoked, he just started shouting random disgusting comments at Giselle and random insults. And what has happened is that WrestleCon not only removed him from the convention and said, "You're gone for the rest of this weekend, you're not welcome back here," but he has been banned for life from WrestleCon. Rick Steiner is no longer allowed to participate going forward in any of the activities at WrestleCon. And good. Fuck him. There's no excuse for him to behave in the way that he did. Do I think that had to do with the reaction here to Bron Breakker? I don't. Because as I said, people have already been tiring of this run. I don't think... And by the way, why should he be blamed for that anyway? Just because his father is an asshole doesn't mean that Bron Breakker did anything wrong. So let's be clear about that. I think the reason that he was booed is because people wanted Carmelo Hayes. They wanted new blood at the top of the card here in NXT. And they wanted to see a new champion crowned. And so Braun was getting booed. They did, the reaction did shift a little bit as the match went on. Because Braun showed up, man. He showed up. He was working his ass off out there. He had a very good match. I think the people appreciated that. So they came around as the match went on. But outside of a miscue in the ropes, there was a rare miscue by Carmelo Hayes early on. Things were going along fine in the first half. It just never felt to me like it got out of that middle gear. You know, they seemed almost a little bit tentative early. I'm sure some of that was nerves. Breakker hit an impressive run-up Frankensteiner off the top rope. Trick Williams got ejected when he got involved in the match. Breakker speared Hayes into the referee. So you knew some fuckery was coming here. Breakker got the Steiner recliner applied. He got the visual tap. I'm not a fan of that. Unless it plays into a bigger story they want to tell on TV. I know it gives Breakker an out for losing. I just didn't think here it was necessary. And it feels like Carmelo, even though he's a heel, it's like, I don't want to say he's been playing babyface, because he really hasn't been doing anything differently. But the fans are cheering him like a babyface. I just didn't think it was necessary to do that here. Especially if Braun is going to get called up. If he's going to leave, you know, why does he need the visual, you know, the visual pin? Trick Williams reappeared. He hit Breakker with the title belt and then dragged Melo onto Braun, and that got a dangerously close near fall. Hayes countered the press slam that Braun does into a code breaker, and he went up top for the leg slice. Nothing but net. Got the pin to win the NXT championship for the very first time. Breakker handed the belt to Hayes when the match was over and gave him a fist bump out of respect, and the crowd cheered, Carmelo winning like he was the new top babyface. I was half expecting a Trick Williams turn with the idea, you know, I helped you to win the title and now I'm done being your lackey. I want a shot at the title. That could still be where this eventually goes, but it didn't happen here. And it felt like this was the start of a new era for NXT, with Breakker likely being main roster bound after this weekend. So it was not a bad way to spend a Saturday afternoon, or morning, I guess if you're out on the West Coast, but I've been spoiled by those old Mania weekend shows, man. I've been spoiled by those shows they used to do. These don't have the same vibe, but the wrestling is largely good, and it was the right outcome in the main event. Now, WWE announced the next big NXT show is going to be called NXT Battleground, taking place Sunday, May 28th, Memorial Day weekend in Lowell, Massachusetts. That is the day after the King and Queen of the Ring event in Saudi Arabia. It is the same day as AEW Double or Nothing. Not only the same day, it is running opposite Double or Nothing at the exact same time. Shawn Michaels was asked about that by Ariel Helwani, if they chose that date to compete with AEW. And, I mean, what did you expect him to say? I mean, he said no. I don't get the sense Shawn is really clued into a lot of this shit anyway. I think they just come to him and say, hey, this is how it's going to be. And he's like, okay. But he said no. He pointed out that they've done well on the holidays. And it's his understanding That is why they did that. He said holidays were big days for them, and that's why they did it. He said that was the date that was available. I see, I'm not sure what he means by that. If he's talking about kind of in the greater abstract, or is he talking specifically NXT? Because NXT does these holiday-themed shows sometimes, like they did New Year's Evil, or they might do something on Valentine's, or you know, the Great American Bash. But those are regular NXT episodes at the PC, in front of the same fucking people that they perform in front of every week. What big holiday shows on the road, you know, like a pay-per-view type show, are they doing in NXT? I mean, I Halloween Havoc is another one. Halloween Havoc, I'm pretty sure that was just a regular episode of NXT. So I'm not really sure what he means by that, unless he's talking about WWE, you know, in general, like when they did Clash at the Castle on Labor Day weekend last year. I'm not sure exactly what he's talking about, but he said that was the date that was available. That's what he said. That's what he said. I know what I'll be watching that night, and it won't be NXT. It will be Double or Nothing. Battleground is going to have to wait. Let's get to some of your questions here. We haven't had a good mailbag in a couple of weeks, so I want to give you guys some airtime here. You could always email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Let us do our WrestleMania-sized mailbag here. We'll start with Caleb from Minnesota. Said, not a question, just a thank you. I want a copy of WWE 2K23 because I knew from listening to you that John Cena only has 5 WrestleMania main events. So thanks, pal. You see? It pays to listen to this show. Caleb, you're very welcome. Jose from Tucson, Arizona. Have you heard or know anything about WWE's legal issue with the SEC and federal prosecutors regarding the hush money scandal? And would that make a potential buyer more hesitant to purchase WWE? I have not heard anything new since the news came out last summer that the SEC and prosecutors, they had launched inquiries into the hush money payments. I assume nothing is going to come out of it. And Vince just paid back $17 million to the company. So I assume it's a dead issue now. As far as whether it might make potential buyers a little skittish, I doubt it. You know, there's said to be a lot of interest right now from quite a few different parties in buying the company. David Faber was on CNBC this week saying as much, although he once again reaffirmed what he said a few months ago when Nick Khan was on the air with him. He said that Comcast is not interested. But he said that Endeavor, which has said they don't want to take on any more debt. He said Endeavor is still, you know, a possibility, and the Saudis are a possibility. So apparently not. Apparently it's not going to scare off too many people. Daniel from New Orleans. By the way, thank you for the nice words on 800 episodes. Daniel has heard me talking about Sting's final year in AEW. And the idea that I pitched was to have MJF be the one to retire Sting, which would serve as the catalyst for Darby Allin to then challenge MJF for the world title, either at Full Gear or they could do it at Revolution next year. He has a slightly different take on that idea that really intrigued me. But ultimately, it leads to the same place with Darby and MJF, but I wanted to share it with you here. He said Darby is number one contender towards the end of the year. MJF makes Darby go through the normal trials as he puts his opponents through. We know Darby is willing to do some sick and dangerous spots, and MJF exploits that. Every match is some sort of hardcore-type match, and Darby, being the twisted fool that he is, finds a way to win them all. Broken, beaten, and bruised, MJF reveals the final challenge. A submission match. Darby's last trial is Sting. And here's the kicker. If Sting wins, he gets Darby's title shot. But if Sting loses, he has to retire. This would give Sting a huge incentive. His first world title match in nearly a decade. Both men will be conflicted while MJF soaks it all up. MJF makes Darby put down his mentor on his quest to win gold. Darby putting Sting into retirement should all but guarantee Darby would take the title off of MJF. And who will be there to put the title around his waist in those closing moments? Sting. What do you think? I really like that idea. I really like that idea because it completely fits with MJF being the raging asshole that he is. That he would force Darby to be the one to retire Sting. Right? He has to choose what's more important to him. Sting's career or the championship. And Darby would probably refuse to do it at first, and then we can get one last great promo segment in the ring with Sting, you know, yelling at Darby and talking about his career and what it took for him to become a champion in WCW and fighting through adversity, you know, sometimes doing things he didn't want to do just to make a name for himself. He wants Darby to do the same. I don't want to hold you back, because I won't. I need to prove to myself that I can do it one more time, and if I can't, I wouldn't want it to be anybody else but you. Right? That's it. Now that's powerful shit. I like it. It does create the likely scenario, though, where the fans would boo Darby because they wouldn't want to see Sting lose. But in the end, Sting would endorse him. Everybody would want to see Darby be the one to, you know, end the reign of terror. I think that's great stuff. Isaiah from Philly. I'm watching a parts fun known video about opening matches at WrestleMania, and Adam Blompier said something that has me thinking. Basically, could the Money in the Bank participants be determined by whoever has the most eliminations in the Royal Rumble? The Money in the Bank matches would have to be moved back to WrestleMania for this to work, but how does this sound? It would make the Rumble serve as the catalyst for the entire year, basically. No, I don't like that idea. I don't like it. The Rumble already serves a purpose, which is to decide who gets a championship match at WrestleMania. That's good enough. The Money in the Bank matches, they are not being moved back to WrestleMania anyway, so I feel like it's all moot. They have weeks of television to fill leading into the Money in the Bank pay-per-view. It makes more sense to decide the participants in qualifying matches. You can probably pad at least a couple of weeks worth, if not more, of television just by qualifying matches alone. You got two Money in the Bank matches, right? One for the men, one for the women. You got to fill TV time somehow. Instead of having random matches, you want to have them mean something. That's one way to do it. And look, there may be people that you want in Money in the Bank who are not going to be in the Royal Rumble match. What do you do then? Maybe they already have a match on the Rumble card, you know, earlier that night, and they're not in the Rumble. Maybe they're out hurt. They're on the injury list. And they're not coming back until after the show. What do you do then? So I'm not a fan of doing it that way. Steve from Virginia, I have two questions for you. First, what do you think of people calling modern wrestling more like superhero fighting than what traditional wrestling was in the past? I've never heard anybody call wrestling superhero fighting. I've heard them call it spot fests or, you know, dance routines. I can't say that I've ever heard anybody call it superhero fighting. It was superhero fighting when I was a kid because the wrestlers looked like real-life superheroes. They were mostly big with muscles, big muscles. Today, a lot of them look like the person I would see on the street. You know, not all of them, but a lot more than there used to be. It's just a different time now. His second question is, how much do you think ECW contributed to modern wrestling with matches like RVD against Jerry Lynn? These were the matches that prioritized spots more than psychology and storytelling. See, I disagree that just because a match has a lot of spots means that it has no psychology or storytelling. That's not some universal truth, but RVD against Jerry Lynn was highly influential to the style of matches that we see today. Some people see that as a negative. Some people see that as a positive. It makes for a more exciting, fast-paced style of match. But I personally don't like all the matches to be that way. For some wrestlers, that style of match makes sense. It doesn't make sense for everyone. I like my wrestling to have a mix of different styles. Sometimes I'm going to like it. Sometimes I'm not going to like it. I would not want them all, though, to be like RVD against Jerry Lynn. You know, what those two were doing back then, though, was very innovative. Today, it would be just another match in segment 4 on Dynamite. Back then, people were buzzing about it because they didn't see that sort of thing. Lewis says, do you think Demolition would still have been a successful team if Moondog Rex stayed as Smash before being replaced by Barry Darso? I have no idea. Probably not, if I had to guess. From what I saw of Moondog Rex, he was nothing special in the ring or on promos. Darso was the right guy at the right time for the role. You know, so was Bill Eadie. And they both had played other successful characters before, but Demolition was awesome. Moondog Rex had some bad luck in the WWF, though. They put the tag team titles on the Moondogs, but then they replaced his partner. I don't know what the issue was, but his partner got replaced, and then they ended up dropping the titles after only a few months. They never got them back again. After that, they were pretty much a lower-level team, you know, doing jobs. Until many years later, you know, he came back, and he got repackaged as Demolition Smash. Problem is, the fans could tell that it was him, and they chanted Moondog at him, which is why they replaced him with Barry Darso. Maybe it would have worked out for him, maybe not, but that's gotta suck, you know, to get bounced from the role because you were too recognizable. Then you see Demolition go on to have the kind of success that they did. You know, Rex was probably like Dolph Ziggler. Yeah, he's like, it should have been me. Ty from DC, in your opinion, is the Bloodline story the most difficult story WWE has ever told? From the beginning with the Usos joining Roman to the stuff with Sammy leading into the Rumble turn, now the match with Cody. Then, of course, you have the decision of making Cody champion or not, which in my opinion should be the way the story should conclude from his end. But still having the option of Roman being a 1,000-day champion and circling back to Jay. The web is being spun in a lot of fun yet confusing directions at times. What are your thoughts? It probably is the most difficult story that they've done, just because there are so many different directions they could take it in, and it's been going on for so long. Like, I would have said the same thing about the NWO story in WCW. It went on for so long, there were a lot of directions you could have gone with it. This is probably the most difficult because Triple H has to make these decisions. Is now the time to take the titles from Roman? Is this not time to take the titles from Roman? Now that the Usos have lost the titles, what do you do with them? Where does Solo Sikoa fit into all this? When Roman does lose the titles, what happens with him and Paul Heyman? Does he keep the wise man? Does the wise man leave and go with somebody else? You know, there's a lot of different directions you could take it in. It's not easy, you know? But that they don't pay me to do creative for WWE. That's Triple H's job. So he'll have to make those calls and figure it out. But, you know, it's a hell of a story, though. I would imagine it's a lot of fun to sit in a room with a bunch of people and you have all of these different options that you can go in. I'd much rather have a story like this going than have no story at all. Right? I mean, this is the kind of story I think that if you're a writer, I would imagine you probably are loving this shit. You're probably embracing it and trying to figure out how long can we prolong this. How long can we drag this out for before we beat a dead horse? And Jose from NYC. Since we are on the road to WrestleMania, can you rank all of the WrestleManias that you attended live as far as live experience and the show overall? Yes. So I went to 8 WrestleManias, 28 through 35. 30 in New Orleans was my favorite out of all of them. The show itself was great. Being in New Orleans for the first time was great. We, you know, rented a house right on Bourbon Street. That was a blast. I also had some damn fine char-grilled oysters for the first time. Shout out to Drago Seafood at the Hilton. So 30 is number one. I would go 28 in Miami for the overall experience. You know, we were up in the media box for the first match. We ended up heading down to the friends and family section on the floor. I don't even remember how we did that. I just remember how close we were to the stage and the ramp and just being in awe of the entire thing. Plus, it was my first. And I had the chance to interview so many different people. John Cena, Shawn Michaels, Edge, Daniel Bryan, Arn and Tully. The Brock return on Raw the next night was great to be in the building for that. 34 was back in New Orleans. That was not a great week for me for obvious reasons, but damn if I didn't have fun that weekend. So I'd put 34 in there next. 32 was not a great WrestleMania, but it was my first time in Dallas. Food was great. Everyone told me, oh, you got it. Dallas has the best food, best barbecue. It's true. Food was outstanding. People were great. I did my first live sound off. We packed the place the morning after WrestleMania. I'm upset because I have file folders for each WrestleMania on the computer that I have been to. And all of my photos and videos are in these folders. And I don't know what happened. I lost my WrestleMania 32 folder. So I still have a lot of stuff on my phone. But I know there was a video someone shot from the live podcast that was in the folder. Like, the folders now, they go from 31 to 33. And I just can't for the life of me figure out what the hell happened to 32. There was so much shit in that folder. Like, there's no way I accidentally deleted it, because just to delete that entire folder with all the files in there, it would have taken forever to delete. You know, I would have realized my mistake. I checked other folders to see if I accidentally dropped it in one of them. I don't know. I can't find this thing. But for the experience, I would say 32. Then 31. And 31 was an excellent WrestleMania. Then I would go 33 in Orlando. That was the 7-hour show. I thought we were seeing Undertaker's last match. I felt, oh, this is special to be here for his last match. And then, of course, I felt like a fool after that. But I got to work the floor that weekend doing interviews at WrestleCon for Fight, and got to chat with Mean Gene and Demolition and a lot of other people. And I would put the two local WrestleManias dead last. I'd put 29 in the second to last spot, and then 35. 29 weekend was fun. That was in 2013. WrestleMania 29 weekend was fun. We went to the Roast of the Iron Sheik. I got to go to a Chikara show for the first time, Supercard of Honor. I got to see the second best Money in the Bank cash-in of all time when Dolph Ziggler won the world title from Del Dipshit. So that's how I would rank them from my own experience. I go 30, 28, 34, 32, 31, 33, 29, and 35. I feel like I'm giving you lotto numbers. Actually, you know what? I should play these numbers. What are the likelihood that these would come up? These are all, like, all these numbers are bunched together. I'd probably lose, right? Maybe I'll play lotto. Anyway, good shit. Keep sending those questions in. I love hearing from you guys. I do see everything you email me, even if I can't always respond back. TheSolemonster@gmail.com. Follow on Twitter, @Solemonster. I was tweeting up a storm last night. I'll be doing the same tonight. Live again after night 2 of WrestleMania on YouTube. This is it. It all comes down to this tonight. Roman Reigns, is this the night, finally, that he drops the championship? Or is Cody just another cog in the wheel that keeps on spinning? I don't know. We'll find out. But if it's anywhere as good as last night was, then this is going to be a good night. So be well. Stay safe. I'll be back with you next weekend. That'll be episode 803 of the Solemonster Sounds Off, over 15 years. Still going strong. Thanks to all of you. I'll see you next Sunday. Take care.
The Solemonster Sounds Off.
Here is who was in this illustrious Andre the Giant Memorial Battle Royal. Bobby Lashley, Braun Strowman, LA Knight, Xavier Woods, Baron Corbin, Karrion Kross, Bronson Reed, Johnny Gargano, Dexter Lumis, Madcap Moss, Shelton Benjamin, Solemonster, Elias,
Rick Boogs, Mustafa Ali, Dolph Ziggler, Butch, Ridge Holland, Santos Escobar, Ashanti Viadonis, Top Rope Dala, Los Lucario, Cedric Alexander, Carl Anderson,
Luke Gallows,
Matt Faye, Mansla, Joaquin Wilde, and Cruz Delta.
There is the roster for this illustrious battle royal. I stuck an extra one in there just to make sure you were paying attention.
The Solemonster Sounds Off, each week bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solemonster on Twitter @Solemonster.
Solemonster.
Solemonster.
Solemonster Sounds Off.